MotoGP 2012 about to get underway here in Qatar. And a great start from Stoner and from Ben Spies on that second row of the grid actually as well.
Hello and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 314 for Wednesday, the 11th of April, 2012. My name is Martin Darlington. I am in the northeastern corner of Wales, very close to the English border, where it's been hailing today. And with me, as ever, is Jim Race across in California. What's your weather like, Jim?
It's shit.
Yeah. We've actually got some beautiful sunshine interspersed with hailstones from very strong April showers.
For the last 2 days, it's been, it was 72 Fahrenheit and beautiful and gorgeous, even though we had some interesting cloud structures coming over, but we knew that there was a low pressure system that was coming in on the back of it. It's funny, we always talk about weather, but I think it's interesting since we have an intercontinental show, if you will. And for the last 4 hours, it has just been raining down cats, dogs, and various other animals, and it's been a mess. But in the best of Motopod traditions, that doesn't mean that I haven't made it to the grocery store and picked up a...
Well, I'm still working my way through a bottle of Krabby's, which is alcoholic ginger beer, but I do have my can of Guinness in reserve ready to go. But I'm not ready to open it yet, so I'll have to do that later in the show.
You save that for later. We do have some interviews going for this week, don't we?
We do indeed.
We've got Steve Rapp. Now, Steve Rapp, some of you guys might know, probably mostly from the American front, although I believe he did have one. Did he ever have a World Superbike wildcard? I'm not sure. No, that was anyway. He has been confirmed as a CRT wildcard for both U.S. rounds with Attack Kawasaki, a team and builder here in the States that really, really knows how to build bikes. And in fact, I'm going to be talking to their principal, or my intent is to talk to their principal probably for next week's show. So that's going to be about 15 minutes. I just got off the phone, Martin, with Chris Walker, Chris the Stalker Walker. Currently riding for Kawasaki Primo Bermuth Kawasaki Racing in BSB. Did quite well in what was pretty much a dismal BSB round this last Monday, wasn't it?
Well, it was half a BSB round.
Yeah, half a BSB round. And it sounds like they're not going to actually rerun that second race, which I think is kind of weird.
Well, when they stopped it, when they've stopped them before for crashes.
They pushed them out, yeah.
Yeah, they'll redo them. The one they didn't do, of course, was the opening round, I think it was 2 years ago, where Brands was under snow.
Yep.
And those just got canned. They couldn't fit two races in later on the season. I don't think they bothered at all then. But yep.
We shall see what they do. And in fact, Chris and I touched on that because I remember the pictures from those were pretty cool. There was a couple of guys snowboarding down the steep part of the...
Yeah.
and then... everybody's perennial favorite, Mr. Mark Miller. You guys that managed to listen all the way through the end of the very, 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 very end of the show last week probably got a bit of a taste of that. And whenever Mark and I talk, but we chat a whole bunch about what's going on with his plans for 2012, as well as General Jim Race and Mark Miller banter. Not sure what order we're going to load those in. So very, very cool. And I'm pretty stoked about that. We did have some excellent donators in the last week. I cannot tell you guys how much this helps, especially when I'm having to maintain two studios right now. It actually, if the sound quality sounds even better, there's a good reason for it. You guys have helped us out with this. So to those of you out there in Motopod land, Carl Hun, Papa Thiam, who I would like to title as curmudgeon extraordinaire. And he knows well why. Peter Newell and Ken Haylock, dudes. Many, many thanks. Tip of the Motopod hat to you guys. Really, really appreciate it. If you'd like to donate to the show, you can do so through the Facebook fan page. Don't have to sign up for Facebook. You can just do it through facebook.com/motopod or through motopodcast.com. Our MCN Fantasy League, Martin, is still growing, and I'm not very happy at the moment myself.
Well, I did take a while to find you. Yeah, there's a lot of scrolling down involved.
Damn it.
Yes. You got a bit bitten there, didn't you?
Well, I did. Both of my riders crashed out.
Well, I thought I was taking the gamble, but I thought there's only one MotoGP race, and there were four BSB, two still to come, of course. As it turned out, there'll only be three, and four World Superbike races. So I loaded up my World Superbike and BSB teams. But Bautista and Bradle, they did pretty well. With two MotoGP lads. Obviously, that's now going to need a bit of reshuffling. And I'm sorry, Jorge, I didn't have you in my team because you're too bloody expensive, because you're too bloody good.
I know.
But you will be soon.
I actually apologized to Sylvain Quintoli when I interviewed him the other day. Offline, I said, I would have had you instead of Kuba, but you were too expensive.
Yeah.
But Jules is currently leading the three of us presenters at the moment, or the four or five of us, but the regulars, and has had a pretty good run. You scored well with Seeley in second, and I forget where Shaky came in. Somewhere
six. Hang on, I've got the results here. Sixth or seventh, I think.
Yeah. So.
Seventh.
I had Hill and Florino and
Tommy didn't have a good time.
No, he didn't. Well, you qualified 29th, if I remember. And I'm like, oh, this is not going to be a good start. And from what I understand, he was running, I haven't looked at all the timesheets, but he was running very competitively near the front and with like a lap to go. But apparently it was a total mess. We'll talk about BSB in a bit. And so we've only got one round left before we can start swapping riders, that being Thruxton coming up this weekend.
Yep. And the two very, very good friends I have who are the two Thruxton-based air ambulance pilots for Hampshire. I was talking to Dave Bronneman today, who is a big, big bike racing fan. And he's off, and he's off to the Lake District to do some crazy downhill mountain biking. And the other chap, Stu Mayer, who was one of the ushers at my wedding last year, a very good friend of mine, has absolutely no interest in anything that only has two wheels. And he's on duty. So he's going to sit there going, boring. He's probably going to have the same attitude as I did when I did the duty there and they had truck racing. is funny for about three laps and then it's quite noisy and tedious. So I went inside and made a coffee and read a book.
You're talking about the lorry racing stuff.
Yeah, that Barry Sheen and Steve Parrish did when they finished bike racing.
Yeah.
It's 18-wheeler cabs without the trailers on the back.
You know, I've seen, and this is a classic UK thing too, people racing with caravans, what we call campers, on the back.
Yeah.
And it's basically a destruction derby because the guys are trying to,
Well, it is on Top Gear because Top Gear's sworn mission is to destroy every caravan in the world.
Yeah.
you guys don't have truck racing in America?
Not the big 18-wheeler ones. No, not. I've never
seen. I just presumed it came from there. I mean, you guys race everything. Tractors.
Yep.
These massive saloon cars that go around corners like ships.
We've got swamp buggies here, and if you've never looked that up on YouTube, Martin, look up swamp buggy. It will be or swamp racing. They have.
Is this the boats or the big fan on the back rather than a propeller in the water?
No, they've got both, but they've got ones that are basically like Formula One cars that run on these quote unquote road/water courses, and these things are insanely fast. But we are diverging from our main thing, and we know this is going to be a long show. We should probably just get into it.
We should. We got a little bit of listener feedback. In fact, we potentially would have a massive amount of listener feedback. However, we'll deal with the little ones at first. Gary Shavitt sent in an email. Gary, a very good friend of the show, and asking if Louis Salom in Moto3 and David Salom from World Superbikes are related, and our answer is yes.
We think.
We have no idea in what capacity. We don't think they're husband and wife, but they may be uncle, nephew, cousins, father, son. No, they're not father, son. David's not nearly old enough. So yes, Gary, until we're proved otherwise. Frank McEwen wrote in and asked, what the hell is going on with Rossi? Well, we'll come to that, right?
Yeah, we'll come to that, won't we?
I don't think we're going to be able to do a review of the opening round of the MotoGP without discussing that. And Paul Creevy was... I'm not meant to say that, am I?
No, Paul. No, it's fine. Nomad from the desert. Sorry, Paul. You've been outed.
sent in a fantastic Qatar review. Because Paul works out in the Middle East, and he managed to get down to Qatar. He did have some interesting stories about actually getting into the country, where you have to. They struggle apparently to understand what your job title is if it's not on their list of job titles, because there's only 40, right, according to people in Qatar apparently. And if it doesn't match what they've got written down, they presume you're a pirate or something. I don't know. But fantastic email, Paul. Unfortunately, with the amount of stuff we've got to get through, we're not going to have time to go through it bit by bit. But all three of us have been in conversation with Paul. I really enjoyed his email. Do please keep them coming. But
I believe he's the new Martin Darlington.
Well, I did say to him, I said, be careful, you know, what you do, because look where it ended me up. But yeah, it was a really – I love those emails you get from people there where it's just – they haven't sat and planned the letter. It's just stream of consciousness, because you get their really deep, honest thoughts. And sometimes, even though a sentence will diverge into another sentence or another subject and then come back, the direction it goes is quite illuminating as to their mindset when they started that sentence out. And I think that's far more intimate, and it's far more revealing than if someone plans, oh no, I'll edit this and chop that. So I just used to sit down. It helps I can touch type, because I can pretty much type at the speed of my thoughts when I can't write at the speed of my thoughts. I can, I just can't read what I've written afterwards. But I just sit down and just go, as you guys found out. And, you know, so.
And like you say, look where it got you. I remember I was out when his email came in and popped in, and I pulled it up on my phone, and I'm scrolling. And I think it had been a good 10 to 15 swipes on the phone. And I scrolled back to the top. I hit reply. I said, this may take more than one sitting, my friend, but thank you so much. So
yeah,
very, very cool. In fact, I think what we may do is probably revisit that next week. But the one thing that we do have to talk about, and certainly led into some of the stuff that Paul talked about Qatar. Dude, we had what I would consider a barn burning, killer, kick ass opening weekend from Qatar, which we don't always have.
It could not have been much better, could it?
No.
We had the Moto3s, and it was funny because watching practicing and qualifying over the weekend, where you get one bike going by, another bike going by, I'm hearing these sort of, and I'm thinking, ooh. And I tweeted David Emmett and Ian Wheeler and the guys who are out there, and I was like, do they sound any better live than they do on telly? Because they sound a bit flat. Obviously, they were far too busy to reply to a minion like me, so I never really got an opinion. But the race, I thought, actually, when there's a mass of them, they sound pretty bloody cool.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And we watched qualifying. We had Sandro Cortese got himself on pole position. Maverick Vinales, no surprise there, was in second for the grid. Louis Rossi. The French Rossi,
yep,
and Louis Salom, already mentioned, started heading up the second row with Nicky Io and Romano Fanati. Now, this is not a name that I'm going to pretend that I'd ever heard before this weekend, but
go.
with the hindsight of what's happened, a lot of people who watch CIV, which is the Italian version of the Spanish CEV, have said it was not a surprise to see him do what he did. I saw him interviewed afterwards in heavily accented but very, very fluent English, and he just came across it. He was another. Do you remember seeing Bradley Smith interviewed at the age of 15? Maverick Vinales, Marc Marquez, very self-contained, very conscious of, you know, what they're saying, how it's going to be portrayed. And I thought, oof, clever boy. I think some of the comments that have come from particularly fans, right, that's a world champion in the next 4 years at the top level. You think, it's one race.
Right.
It's one race. Let's not put too much pressure on the boy. And Gonzalez will be happy because Miguel Oliveira qualified eighth. Danny Kent, after such dominant shows through the winter testing, was only 12th. And he struggled a bit. Having said that, he was very dominant at Jerez, where we're going next. So I think hopefully he'll come good.
If there was one thing that I was pleased about is that there was we basically for Moto 3 have a two motor series right now. I don't know if I'm necessarily pleased about that. I would like to see additional motors from additional manufacturers being there, but you have to understand that the cost and logistics of providing what has to be what I guess they have to be able to create and supply 50 motors. Should they be required, is, you know, kind of staggering in a bit. And KTM and Honda are probably two of the only manufacturers can do so. But there was a great mix in qualifying. And frankly, there was also a great mix in the race.
Yeah, I mean, everyone seemed to feel that the KTMs were the strongest package.
Right.
And the only Honda that was likely to challenge them was Vinales because of Vinales, not the Honda. And actually, it turned out to be a fairly happy mix.
It did, absolutely. The Moto 3 race started off. It's a little bit different now when we, and it seems like even more so. It was fun. I watched it a lot. I'm not sure if you did. I watched it through MotoGP.com, and I started watching. I think a good 45 minutes. I always know to go directly to the live video page because if you wait for the little green thing to pop up on the front page,
you get to see what the results were.
Yeah, well, and you may be 15 minutes late.
And if
you sit there and camp out on the live video page, as soon as they start up their video, it kicks in. So,
shit, I forgot, actually, I've got a little apology to make to the world. I was on duty on Sunday, and our duty finishes at 6 o'clock. The MotoGP race wasn't until 8 UK time, but Moto 3 started at 5. And
you spoiled
it. They were on the grid. We hadn't had a shout all day. It had been really quiet. We'd done one shout in the morning. And this was at the air ambulance base. And at 10 to 5, the bell went.
Yeah.
And I had the mother of all rants. There's never any question that my wish to watch bike racing is going to get in the way of doing my job. So I was just as quick getting out and starting up. But the language I was using, the paramedics were looking at me with a kind of, okay, he's on one.
Okay, and, well, then I have to tell you this before we carry on here. Mm. Jules and I were texting back and forth during, I think, the Moto 2 race. And you went and you had your rant.
Yeah. Well, I was actually in the aircraft starting engines with my iPhone in my hand going, shit, no, I've got a job. Bust. Okay,
so here's what I said to Jules. I said, if Lorenzo is anywhere near the front, near the end of the MotoGP race, we're going to remotely call up the Wales Air Ambulance Service and tell them that we have a kitten stuck up in a tree and it has to be caught because it is a pure breed and it has to be captured now.
Yeah, well, you could get a kitten out of a tree with a helicopter, but I don't think there'd be much left of the kitten at the end of it. Yeah.
Well,
I then felt really guilty because she went out. There was a little 8-year-old girl. She was fine. She'll be okay, but she did need to go and get taken to hospital. So we picked her and mum up and I felt such a shit. And we got back and this is how Mother Nature or the gods or whatever anyone believes in punish us, because we got back from hospital and I knew that the Moto 2 race was starting at 6:20.
Yeah.
And we got back about 4:15 and I said, right, if we go and refuel now, I'm going to miss half the race. So the paramedic I was with, Rodri, said, well, that's all right. You're staying here. I was staying on base overnight. And he said, just, we'll do it in the morning. I said, fine. So I only missed the first three laps of the Moto 2, the whole of the Moto 3. So I had to watch it on Skype the next day. And in the morning, when we went to refuel, it was absolutely belting down with rain. And we had to tow the aircraft around. I'm on this little exposed tractor towing it around, got soaked. Anyway, that's my Moto 3 story. So sorry, world, for ranting about having to go and do my job when I wanted to watch bike racing.
Such as it is. Let's do a quick pass through the results here, and because we do have a whole bunch of stuff that we have to get to, Martin.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Sorry, I'm off on one, aren't I?
Trust me, I'm still laughing at Jules and my conversation. We were sitting there chatting through all 5 hours, so.
Well, what I really liked about this race was we started off, we had the standard, what we're used to seeing, the 125 pack. And in this case, it was the Moto 3 pack. And we had 9 riders tucked in really close together. 9, 10 riders, it might have been at the start. Vinales, Fanati and Cortese started to make a little bit of a gap. Cortese then, did he run wide or run off? I think he just ran wide and dropped back. Vinales gets past Fanati, who'd been leading him for lap after lap. But, and he thought, okay, there you go, he's gone. And then Fanati got back past him. Now, I couldn't see, because the pass he made, the footage I was watching, which was Eurosport, because obviously I need my fix of Julian Ryder and Toby Moody, it just happened that it was the aerial shot, and you couldn't see if Vinales sat up, but Fanati seemed to get past a little bit too easy, and I got the feeling that Vinales was doing one of those cunning racecraft things of, okay, I haven't lost you, I want to see where you're strong and where you're weak. If that was the case, it worked, because Vinales did get past, and in the end, he won by 4 seconds. Cortese, Salom, Oliveira, and Kairuthin had a brilliant battle, and Sisis. This new Sisis, this Australian lad, Arthur Sisis.
Yep.
They had a good battle. Danny Kent rolled in 8th. Louis Rossi was 9th. And then we went back to Alex Rins, Alan Tescher. Hector Faubel, expected to see him further up, and Nicky Io. Alberto Moncoya and Jakob Kornfeil, they saw out the points. Jonas Folger crashed. Masbu. And Isaac Vinales, who is Maverick's cousin, I think. He's not a kid brother, is he? No, I think he's a cousin, and I think he's quite a bit older, actually, than Maverick. I think he's, I say older for most of it, probably 20 as opposed to 16. But it was a really entertaining, good, typical 125cc style punch up just with 4 strokes.
Well, and not only that, as you say, but it certainly did not provide anything less than the entertainment that we had with the 125. Sure, it sounded different, and I think the best comparison that I heard from a sound standpoint was from a guy that was in his 70s who's a racing fan, and he's like, it sounded like the Spitfires coming over for the Battle of Britain. I'm like,
yeah,
good enough. I'll take that one.
And it was interesting. Danny Kent did an interview with Motorcycle News a couple of weeks ago. This is the first 4-stroke he's ever ridden competitively.
Yeah,
because he did that standard thing for most of the Brits, apart from the Cal Crutchlows and the like, who come from World Superbikes. Oh, the young Brits tend to gum through the Spanish CEV system, where it's all been 125s and 2-strokes, and this is the first 4-stroke. And he said, this is amazing. I shut the throttle and it brakes for me.
Oh, yeah.
I had, it's so long since I've ever ridden a 2-stroke. I mean, God, I was probably a teenager the last time I rode a 2-stroke, that you forget you don't get the engine braking. And, you know, it was really interesting to read this article. Very thoughtful young man.
Yeah, there's been some great writing. In fact, I haven't had a chance to read GP Week yet this week, and I'm sure I should, because I bet there's some really good writing in there.
Me neither.
Yeah, and frankly, I should go back and read whatever Dennis Noyes wrote up on Speed after having him on last week. Moto2 certainly lived up to its rep. Thomas Luthi has been basically on the charge and on the ball and kicking ass all through practice and preseason. Your top 10, we'll just walk through them. We'll go through the top 12, I think. Luthi, Marquez, Ainone, Espargaró, the younger brother of Aleix, Mike DiMeglio, Nick Kirchner, Esteve Rabat, Corti, Takaki Nakagami, who didn't figure later, Simone Corse, Julian Simone, and Bradley Smith. Those are your
that's,
top 12.
Yeah, that's the grid for qualifying, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But no Tony Elias,
yep,
and no Nico Tirol. So the Aspart guys, not that strongly positioned.
But you know that they'll go, okay.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Do we?
I do. They're no Bluesons 250. Oops, that was Matt Ladvoice, 250 squad from the days past. whoops, there's an interview that I'm not going to get.
Oof.
But the race turned out to be
classic. It was brilliant.
Yeah. I'm not sure that I've had a funner one. And on top of that, you know, it's really funny, Martin, when Moto2 came into being, one of the things that we grew to expect in the first year was just like a complete crash fest.
Yeah.
And it's like, how many corners can they make before half the field is gone? I mean, okay, a slight exaggeration, but it seemed like it.
Oh, it was diddly bonk bonk.
Yeah. And this has been a very, I think after a while, guys realized, A, we can't break the bikes down. Plus, you've only got one now. You don't have two like you used to have in the past.
Yeah.
Which played into qualifying quite a bit, if we remember.
Yeah.
And so people are a bit more cautious, but I would not say by any means that this was not a very aggressive race by all of the front runners, man. This was balls out, we're going for it, let's get the game on, and I'm getting there first.
Well, they all seem to be doing a sort of schizophrenic impression of James Toseland and Max Biaggi. James Toseland in the sense that they were bashing fairings and elbowing through each other, then being really smooth, just like Max, and then running wide, just like Max, and dropping back. It was like, you know, the peloton when you get the mm-hmm. cycle racing,
yep,
and you get the team, and the front guy peels off and drops to the back. He had Luthi at the front, yeah, and he goes back to six. Marquez at the front, he goes back to eighth. And then they work their way back up through. And this leading group, Marc Marquez, Iannone, Espargaro, Rabat, Luthi, Redding, Scott Redding never really got into their leading group. He was always with it, but at the back of it. Mike DiMeglio, now, mm-hmm, started promisingly in Moto2 2 years ago. Last year, didn't really feature that much. Simone, I'm actually giving away the finishing order here. Bradley Smith had a good battle with Scott for a lot of the race. Mika Kallio, Randy Krumanacker, Johan Zarco, obviously Nico Tirol's sparring partner from last year in 125s. You know, these guys were all mixing it up. And it took a long, long time before there was any kind of spread. It was typical Moto2. You had groups fighting with each other with little gaps between them, but there was never really a breakaway. And the talking point.
Before we get to that,
go on.
You're absolutely right about your Peloton comment was spot on, because turn one for many of the guys in Moto2 was very, very consistently where guys had run wide and they'd end up four or five positions back.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like lap after lap for a while. And you're like, okay. And part of me wondered if that was an issue with the Dunlop tires, but I think part of, I think the sense in me said, no, these guys are just being incredibly aggressive, breaking into turn one, and nobody wants to give up any space. And that leads into what you were about to talk about, which is a very controversial thing. There's nobody in the middle on this one, Martin. People are on one side of the fence or the other.
I'm kind of in the middle now. So basically what's happened is we've got Tom Lethy and Marc Marquez have been sharing the lead. Ian Oni's had it for a bit. Paul Espargaró had it for quite a while. And Simone Corsi on that fairly weird-looking pale blue bike. And, and they're all mixing it up. And Corsi's gone wide and dropped way back, and he never really recovered from it. But we had Marquez following Luthi, Tom Luthi, the Swiss rider. And they came to the end of the penultimate lap. So this pass happened on the last lap, but right at the beginning of it. So they've gone down the long home straight. Ridiculous length. It was a kilometre or whatever it is. He gets to the end. He's drafted him. Now, for the previous three or four laps,
he's been
tucked in behind. Then he sat up with that classic thing of, no, I don't want to go past you yet. I don't want to go past you yet. Then he decides to go past. He gets past. Now, when I watched it live, and I was very vocal in my, this is not, because people were comparing it to Zarco pushing to roll off. Why wasn't Marquez's result shit canned by race direction? And I said, no, he got completely passed. Then he moved on to the racing line. And I'm sorry, but if Luthi doesn't anticipate that and break, you know, at his normal point or a little bit early, and he could have actually tucked inside because Marquez is defending the outside line. When I watched it on the replays from a different angle, he's not convinced he was completely passed.
Well,
So he pushed Luthi onto the red and white striped rumble strip, which supposedly is not the best place to get the maximum braking performance. So Marquez pushes in wide, turns in. Luthi has run completely wide and used the and everyone says about Qatar, if you're offline, you're on marbles because it's dusty. So Luthi drops way back and ends up coming in fifth. Although Ian Oni was right on Marquez. I mean, it was 0.061 was the winning margin. But then if you're in a drag race, Ian Oni's not the smallest bloke. Marquez is. The people have been saying that those cannot be the same engines because Marquez gets so much performance. Maybe he's just really, really good at doing a stoner and getting the power down really early as he comes out of the corner. I don't know. But he's a little diddy little guy. So anyway, he wins. Ian Oni second. Paul Espargaró came in third. Esteve Rabat just behind him in fourth. A little way further back from that was Tom Luthi. Then we had Scott Redding, Mike D'Amelio, and Simone Corsi in a little peloton of their own. Luthi on the warm down lap, it was stoner-esque, but
stoner-esque is the perfect way to put it.
he slapped Marquez's arm as he went. It wasn't dangerous. He didn't assault him. He slapped his arm to get his attention. And you saw, it was quite interesting, you saw Tom Luthi ride alongside Andrea Iannone. They shook hands, and you could see him doing a mite. It was like a charades, you know. It's a film. It's got three words. The bastard cheated, you know.
Okay, so Martin, let me give you my take because I think
absolutely. Don't stop me now, I'll keep going all night.
Yeah, you will. As a former racer, although a puncher, of course, did he take him offline? Yes. Did he put him up on the rumble strips? Absolutely. Was he past him? We really were never able to tell from the video that showed. That being said, the wisest thing in my mind for Luthi to have done at that point was to have got on the binders just a tad, fallen in behind him, and taken the opportunity to pass him in what would have been one of the next 15 corners, instead of falling that far back. Now, had it been another track besides Qatar, where there's ample runoff and plenty of tarmac out there to turn around on, and Lucian ended up maybe in the gravel, in a pile of hurt, that would have been different. Now, let's go back a couple of years ago to, I don't know, 2010 Malaysia, Simoncelli and Ayama coming out of the final turn when, God bless his heart, Marco completely punted Ayama off the track.
But that was more to, he did not turn, he refused to turn in. He didn't turn, he could have made the corner, but he was more interested in pushing Ayama to the edge or off the track. So he didn't actually turn in. Whereas Marquez never hesitated with his turn in. It's just the line he took prior to it.
We could argue this all day. It's part of it's the same
have
logic.
Have you watched it on MotoGP.com?
Oh, yeah. I watched it live, dude.
Right. You were watching it on there because Gavin Emmett and Ian Wheeler got into quite an entertaining verbal spar.
I was exchanging a few emails with one of those gentlemen during this weekend. All right. So the people that actually ended up out of this, out of the Moto2 race, and we do need to move on because this is going to be an incredibly long show.
Yes.
Gino Rey did not have a great weekend. You know, a bit of a baptism of fire. Tough one, finished 28th.
26. You know,
26? Okay.
26.
Max Neukirchner had a really tough weekend, which is sad because he qualified really well up in six. But apparently, I guess, an FP2 or FP3 completely wadded his bike. And this comes back to the one bike rule. Only made one lap in the race. Don't know if he crashed. Not sure what the situation was, but I'm sure it did not help. And so
Alex Dean just binned it with two laps to go. Robbie Rolfe had gone out earlier.
You know, I do have to wonder. Okay, so this is something I thought about. This is my outlawed voice, but I was tempted to call Colin about this. Colin Edwards and Alex DeAngelis probably are not the best of friends because Alex DeAngelis has a reputation for
wiping people out.
At Americans at that.
Well, do you remember he took Colin and Nicky down and Nicky at San Marino and Nicky came out with that classic line of saying, I saw that damn stupid Tutti Frutti crash helmet appear and I thought, shit.
So I think I actually have to call Colin because obviously they're not on the same team, 250 both by NGM forward. But you got to wonder knowing Colin because he's a smart ass and he's good at it. Yep. If there's ever been a little bit of a chat. All right. So very, very cool Moto2 race, man. I mean, it was basically just, you know, in this weekend, I'm like, can it get any better?
Our comment that we've made a couple of times the last few weeks, Moto2, you throw them up in the air and you see where they land.
Yeah.
The last thing I want to say, you've got Tony Liss 13th, Julian Simon 15th, Claudio Corti 16th, Xavier Simeon 17th, Agata 18th, Willerot 21st, Axel Pons, okay, Axel Pons is an accident looking for somewhere to happen, Nico Tirole 23rd. Now, okay, it's his first Moto2 race, but we've seen the champions in 125 generally. Jimmy Simon came up and was in the front. He was pushing podium right from the start. Ricky Cardoos, we know he can ride. Ant West is, you know, well, he's not really had much testing time in it. Gino Rea, I expected a bit more from, but again, first race. But again, there is that. And you can almost guarantee that, yes, Marquez is going to be at the front in the next race. He's going to be there or thereabouts. So's Tom Lutie, so's Iannone. Scott Redding's going to be in single figures, probably Bradley Smith. The rest of them, Julian Simon might win the next race. Claudio Corti could be on the podium. Takahashi is going to be up there for a couple of races. I love the randomness of it, but it also baffles me. I don't understand it.
Yeah, that's the best part, is because what we get to do is we get to watch as things actually even out, and then our opinions and thoughts actually have a foundation. Right now, we've got no foundation, Martin. We've got no idea. It's the best season ever, obviously.
Oh, God. Do you know what? I think for once, it might be the best season for a long time.
Well, frankly, every season is the best season ever because they're still racing. All right. We need to figure out how to move this along because this is going to be a 12-hour show. So,
yeah.
I think what I want to do is go ahead and let's go ahead and run the interview, a very quick one, with Steve Rapp, running the who has been certified, accepted to run the CRT bikes.
I was going to say he's been certified, but you mean like
certified as a loon? Yeah. Well, he's a friend of Mark Martin, so maybe he should be certified. To run CRT bikes run by Attack Kawasaki in both of the U.S. Rounds here in MotoGP. So let's run that. We'll gather our thoughts, Martin, come back and see if we can't roll some of the rest of these interviews and the rest of the news out.
Absolutely.
Jim Race here for Motopod with Steve Rapp. Now, Steve Rapp, as we well know, from AMA and around the paddock for many, many years and has done some amazing things, most commonly on green bikes, at least from my personal imagination. But you've also been kicking ass not only on the XR1200s, but a nice little performance last year on the Mission Motors bike at Laguna Seca. And you, my friend, have something really freaking cool coming up. I don't know how you did this because I've never heard this announced before, but you are on the docket for a pair of CRT rides in both of the MotoGP rounds in this year's series. I don't know how you did it. I don't know how Attack and Richard pulled it off, but I bow my hat and I tip my hat and I'm saying congratulations.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I mean, it's a big change from the start of the year. I didn't really know what I was doing. A lot of uncertainty. And then I went to Richard, and we constantly been trying to put something together for the 2012 season in AMA Superbike. And we were I never worked so hard, and we made a lot of calls and a lot of good things come up. And then Motorcycle Superstore put something together to help us get to Daytona.
Yep.
Which was amazing. And then we went out there last minute, you know, we were on about 2 weeks notice. We showed up there and ran last year's bikes that he rode or that he had. And, you know, we did pretty good considering we just showed up. We didn't test at all. We didn't do anything. So, that was nice. And then this opportunity, with the CRT bikes came up, you know, it was more of his doing as far as, following up on it because he's always wanted to build his own bike, which you never really could do in the AMA as far as their rules go. So, as he heard that, you know, I think he's been on his mind for a while.
Well, there's no doubt that the man actually knows how to tweak the best out of not only the Kawasaki frame, but several other brands. And he's been known to work to the limit of the rules, shall we say. But with all the parts that Attack has put together for that thing over the years, now you have to look at World Superbike as a classic example. And we know that the ZX10 has had its issues in years past with chassis and whatnot. But the motor has always been a total strong horse. So going into it this year with that same motor and whatever Richard Stanboli can come up with for a one-off frame, you've got to be pumped. It's going to be a good bike, dude.
Yeah, I mean, you touched on all the subjects I'm thinking about, too. The bike doesn't exist at the moment. So, I mean, there's nobody that I can think of that could pull this off. I mean, to go from concept to complete bike and be ready to go by July, I mean, that's unheard of. It's almost daunting thinking about it for me, but I think, like you said, Rich is the only guy that I know that could pull this off, and I have the most confidence in him doing it. And, you know, I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be a cool project. We've worked together, so I think it'll make things easier for us as far as the bike setup and just getting the basics done, you know, and getting the bike rolling on a track. So that's kind of the main thing right now. It's just get the bike together, get it on the track, and just see where we can go with it. So it's going to be a lot of fun, and Richard's a great guy, and I think the bike's going to be a great bike just from the get-go.
Cool. Well, I should probably give him a call and like grill him a little bit on tech details. I have to wonder, with the CRT rules, if you guys are going to have any restrictions. And I guess not, because it's a wild card, and wild cards aren't restricted from testing on the actual tracks they intend to run on. So you should be able to actually test that thing at Laguna.
Well, yeah, I think so. I don't know a lot about it either at the moment, but I think that'd be perfect if we could. And, the only problem is there are some noise restrictions at Laguna that I know are in effect, so I don't know how that plays out with everything. But if we could get the bike on Laguna before, that'd be perfect. I just don't know how possible it is or what it would take to get that done. But whatever we need to do, we need to get it on a track anywhere. We need to get it riding. We need to get some laps on it. We need to... You know, there's a lot of stuff that goes into building a bike from the ground up, which a lot of it I don't even know about. So, but Richard will have a good game plan for us, and we'll just go through it like we do with everything. And I think it'll be really, really good.
Cool. Just hearkening back to last year, your ride on the Mission Motors electric bike, and the speeds that you were running on that thing were pretty incredible, considering it was a rather hefty vehicle. It'd be nice to maneuver something that was a little bit lighter, with a lot more horsepower, and something that was actually slightly more predictable, and you didn't have to pay so much attention to the dash around that place.
Yeah, that was my first kind of involvement with riding a bike that had never, ever been ridden ever, was with the Mission Motors bike. And the same idea, concept, put it on paper, built it, brought it to me and said, here it is, see what you can do with it, basically in a roundabout way. And so I would think I was one of the first people, or maybe one of the only people ever to ride it on a track. And we went through the process of just setting it up. They brought some great people in to help us do it with Chuck Warren and some other guys. And we went there, and the lap times were amazing, considering what we were dealing with, a 550-pound motorcycle, equivalently putting out, they said, maybe around 130 to 140 horsepower if it was converted to a regular engine. And so I think we're 9 or 10 seconds off the MotoGP pole on a bike that weighed that much and, with 130 or 40 horsepower. So, I think we come up with a bike that's about 200 or 300 pounds lighter,
Yep.
And I think we can make it a lot better. I think that was a great experience for me, and kind of got me going in the right direction as far as this project also.
Well, yeah, I think probably what it did is it got you noticed in front of the right people in a way.
Yeah, and that too. It's the same people. It's the same weekend. That was an awesome project. I couldn't have been happier with the way it turned out. We tested a couple times with the bike and showed up at Laguna and just went so well. No problems with the bikes, fast laps the whole time, and just, it was great. So I can only hope for things to go that good with this project too.
Cool. You kind of have a reputation for being able to step on a bike that you've got very little experience with and being fast right off the bat. And there aren't a lot of riders out there. And this does come from experience and age, by the way, and I'm right there with you, brother, that have the capability of doing that. Is that something that just is an inherent quality, or is something that you're immediately able to feel in tune with whatever bike you're on?
Well, I think it's a little bit of all those things that you just said. As the years go on, you learn what you like, you learn what you don't like. And so anytime I get on a new bike, it's like I already know about, five things that I need before I can really get aggressive with the bike on the track. So, I get to the bike, and before I even ride it on the track, I call up like Mission Motors when I was with them. I said, look, you guys need to do about four or five things before I even ride the bike, And if you have all those things done, we'll get to the track. It'll make things a lot easier for all of us, and we'll get up to speed a lot quicker. So, I think that just comes from experience and just getting things done, things that I like, and the years of going, through the trials and tribulations of figuring out what I like and what I don't like. So that's kind of, I think, where it comes from.
Cool. Well, as a former AFM racer myself, and you as well, I know that you've been spending a fair amount of time down at California's newest track, Chuckwalla. And last I heard, I think you hold a track record down there, don't you?
Well, yeah, I think it might have changed. You know, there's been a lot of racing going on. But, you know, when I did go out there and ride, that was with the TAC on the ZX10. And we showed up, you know, just we're basically using it as a test. And, you know, Richard's able to bring the best out of me on the bike. And that's a good combination, especially for taking on a task as daunting as jumping into the MotoGP ranks, you know, even in the CRP level. You know, I watched the race in Qatar and, that was, you know, those are even the guys on the CT were actually going pretty good. So, I mean, we definitely got a big road ahead of us and a lot of work to do. But I feel confident that with Richard's knowledge and our relationship we've done in the past, we can come up with something that's new, I think.
Cool. All right. Well, listen, let's talk as the project gets closer to completion. And I think I'll probably give Richard a call maybe in a month or so when he's got things more concrete. But let's you and I talk perhaps in the weeks leading up to Laguna, and we'll definitely talk at Laguna. I think I'm bringing Miller with me up there, so I should probably forewarn you.
No, that's fine. Yeah, we should. You should definitely talk to Richard because he's going to have all sorts of great details as far as, like, you know, bike stuff and just all the more interesting aspects of it from the bike point. And yeah, we can talk anytime. I think the closer it gets, the more we'll know. And I'll probably have ridden the bike at some point, and that'll be some interesting stuff to talk about too. So it'll be kind of just a project we can just work on.
All right, brother. Well, you keep your chin up. Yeah, you're going to Rodé.
Yeah. Oh, so yeah, the other news, which I don't know. Anyway, I think it's official. I don't know. The Motorcycle Superstore guys decided it sounds like they're going to help us for the whole season now.
Nice. Okay. Okay. So this show won't come out until Friday. So you have that much time, Thursday or Friday. So you have that much time to get a press release out.
Yeah. It sounds like that. It sounds like they're working on it. So, yeah, anyway, it's in the works and, that's going to be great too. I mean, you need to ride all year. You can't show up at these MotoGP races, not ever ridden. So it'll be perfect for me to be able to ride with Richard and then just segue right into the other stuff with Laguna and Indy on the CRT bike. So if that all comes to fruition, which it sounds like it is, it'll be a perfect combination.
Right on. You've had some great results and some very interesting happenstances at Rodé in the past, haven't you?
Yeah, you know, I've had a lot of stuff go on, but it's just, it's just a track. I forget about everything. I don't even think about stuff like that. I just go to tracks and they're cement and I'm riding a motorcycle and I try to go as fast as I can basically. So, you know, it's whatever happens in the past, you know.
I'm just giving you shit. You, sir, enjoy your weekend. I hope you run well, and I'm sure the team will put a good, solid bike behind you, and I wish you the best of luck, and we will talk again soon.
Yeah, anytime. Thanks a lot.
All right, man. Cheers.
See you.
All right, so very cool to get a chance to talk with Steve. I wanted to talk to him before, especially when he was running in the AMA. We did get a chance to actually talk about not only his CRT stuff, but about some of the Mission Motors stuff that he'd done. The electric bike last year at Laguna Seca. So it was a very well-rounded interview. And those of you electric bike fans out there will appreciate being able to hear about some of that stuff as well.
It's been a while since we've heard about the e-bikes.
Yeah, it has. And we'll obviously be hearing about them more as time moves on. Jules and I will both be in less than a month at Sears Point, which I think is now called Sears Point, not Infineon anymore, unless somebody picks up the name. So I can call it my home circuit. We did have a MotoGP race, and
I think the best way to introduce this is
there you go. This was
should really been a champagne cork.
It should have.
I haven't got any, so it's Guinness.
The bounced off like about 12 walls because what a kick-ass MotoGP race that was.
I mean, we've always said LaSalle is a bit of a, you know, if it's dull, if it's processional, well, don't worry, it's only LaSalle and it's a bit weird. I don't think I can remember such an exciting start to a season since Welcome in 2004 and Rossi on the Yamaha as a brand new rider on the Yamaha, and it was like, what? Yeah. But it's Derby QP. And qualifying was absolutely fascinating and exciting and frightening, and we had Lorenzo pulled something out and just they were smashing the lap record. Casey was second, and Cal Crutchlow maintained. I mean, how many times have we seen it? Someone in winter testing does really, really well, comes to the race, and they just can't match it. And Cal has been phenomenal since the thousands came in. Seems to suit him, even though, as he put himself, he's only a diddy little bloke. And now, I didn't get this, and you might understand this, Jim. He said, I don't want to get ahead of ourselves because we're still talking about qualifying, but he did say he didn't make a great start. He said, because I'm only little, so I've got no feet on the ground, so I can only use 50% of the launch control. I'm like, what?
I did have to laugh because over the last week, we've had a multitude of Motopod fans like jumping on Cal to come on the show. So Cal, dude, just come on the show. You'll have fun. Trust me.
If we have to wait till Silverstone, I will track him down.
But I want to get one of my – I want to get a Jim Race long interview with him where we can basically abuse the entire English language to our heart's content. He's not so worried. Mr. Crutchlow, eventually I'm going to get you on the show. If that means we have to lock you in a room somewhere, it will happen.
Well, going back to the qualifying, we had Lorenzo Stoner Crutchlow as the front row. Ben Spies, who qualified fourth, but then had a really bizarre crash where it looked like he was trying to save the bike, even though he was hanging on by one hand and being dragged along the floor. Yeah. And then it turned out he actually got a glove caught, and there was a massive amount of speculation that it was the new mandatory brake guards that had caught him, and it turned out, no, it wasn't. It was a left hand got stuck on a bit of the adjustment wheel for the front brake, you tell me.
Yep.
He was fine, although the bikes weren't. We also had crashes from Randy Depunier and James Ellison, which limited them. We had Nicky in fifth, Dovey in sixth, Danny Pedrosa, surprisingly down in seventh, Hector Barber in eighth because he followed people, as everyone was fond of pointing out. Stefan Bradl, brilliant debut weekend.
Sure.
Clever, absolutely. clever boy. Really impressed. He was ninth. Carol Abraham was tenth. So look what we got. Nicky Hayden, Factory Ducati. Then we had Hector Barber, Satellite Ducati. Then we had Carol Abraham, Satellite Ducati. Then Alvaro Bautista in 11th, 12th. Valentino Rossi. And during qualifying, Neil Spaulding was saying Rossi had two bike setups. He had one that he'd been using, the setup that he'd been using, and then he had another one set up the same as Nicky had been using, right, which so apparently is drastically different.
Yeah, a long wheelbase and a short wheelbase.
Yeah. Is it that much pronounced?
Yep.
I didn't get the technicality of what was different, but I did get Neil was saying that they are – they're very, very different. and by the end of QP, even though he'd only qualified 12th, apparently he'd said, for the race, I'm going to use the Nicky Hayden setup because that is better. Colin Edwards, friend of the show, let's face it, everyone's friend, Colin Edwards, was 13th. He was the leading CRT, less than a second behind Valentino Rossi. Then Randy Depugno, who may have improved, but he'd crashed. Alex Espargaro, Yoni Hernandez, Mikel Pirro, Mattia Pessini, Danilo Petrucci, even Silver and James Ellison. I mean, a lot of these guys are still basically in midwinter testing as far as the time they've had on the bikes.
Yep.
We went to the race. It was a pretty good start by everyone. Cal got a little bit swamped, and this comes back to this thing that he said, I've only got short legs, so I can't use all the launch control. First lap, I don't know what happened to Michele Pirro. I don't think he crashed, did he? But they said not enough laps completed was the official classification.
Well, he basically, I think he pitted
three times and was trying to get data for the team, or at least twice, trying to get data for the team, and just they couldn't pull it off. So that's fine.
First DNF was Carroll Abraham. Thankfully, not a crash. He just came into the pits and didn't come out again. But we had Lorenzo led Stone and Pedrosa initially. And I was obviously, I'm a Lorenzo fan. Guys, everyone out there knows it. Guys and girls. But by lap three, Stoner had taken the lead. And it stayed like that. And he pulled a lead out. By lap 11, it was 2.1 seconds. But from lap 15, where it was 1.8, it was kind of fluctuating. It was like Lorenzo had put a bit of a, put the hammer down. Casey would pick it up on his lap board or through 6 cents or whatever and just pick it up again. So it was kind of fluctuating either side of 2 seconds. By lap 18, in three laps, it was down to 0.4. Although that was, yes, Jorge was going quicker lap by lap over those three laps, but Casey was also going much slower. And it turned out this is arm pump. And we'll come on, we'll just talk about it in a minute. But to finish the race, Lorenzo gets past, but Danny...
When we get to the arm pump conversation, let me leave that for you.
Sure. Okay. Danny was struggling to keep up with Jorge, and then suddenly, from somewhere, found a burst, got past Casey. So Casey's down a third. And he started hunting down Jorge. And I'm not convinced he wouldn't have caught him if there'd been two or three laps longer. As it was, he wasn't able to do it. Jorge won by 0.8 of a second from Danny. A couple of seconds behind came Casey. And then we had the Tectoire point scoring train. It was fantastic. Dovi and Cal ran in fourth and fifth for the entire race. But for the first, I've got it written down here somewhere, lap 17, Dovi was leading until, and then Cal got by him, but he never shook him off.
Nope.
And I've said here, Hervé must have been like the cat that got the cream. Thinking back, do you remember those years? I mean, Sylvain Ginzelli.
But at the same time, you could see when they pulled back to him on the camera, Hervé was having kittens.
What, in a good way or a bad way?
He seemed like he was freaked out.
Yeah, but he's French. They don't express themselves in normal emotions. He's crazy. But it was just fantastic to see them. And now I know, I mean, Andrew Wheeler, fantastic MotoGP photographer, has complained. The green apparently doesn't photograph well. Sorry, Andrew. I don't give a shit. When they go that fast, they can paint them whatever color they want. They were absolutely brilliant, the pair of them. And I mean, Cal has just equaled the best British MotoGP result since Jeremy Williams in 2000. You know, he did it at Valencia. He's done it now.
And Martin, I was sitting there, especially as the race. Sorry about that, folks. Especially as the race wound on, and especially as things tightened up at the front, I'm like, Cal's got a shot at the podium here.
Yeah.
Because these boys are getting close, and you know they're going to be hammer and tongs as we get down to the closing laps and people's tires wear off. And, you know, one of the things that we don't have in our notes here, Martin, that we have to talk about, or you know what, let's save this for the next show, because I actually want to gather some more data, because I've got some very interesting information from some of the Bridgestone folks.
Yeah, the tires. I've read the Bridgestone technical report.
Yeah, And I'd like to make that, since we've got a little bit of a break, we'll talk about Bridgestone tires for MotoGP in next week's show, because I think that's an important point. But they certainly did factor in, obviously, here. One of the things that we were talking about and that you mentioned was arm pump, but one of the obvious things that was occurring during this race was tire management and the people that actually were able to take care of their tires. And, you know, race one is always a bit of a crapshoot. But the bonus for us as race fans and as race journalists is that we actually got to see a damn good Qatar MotoGP race, which we haven't seen in, I don't know. I've never come out of a Qatar MotoGP race weekend going,
wow,
that was awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, some people were saying, you know, fantastic, best race, better race than any we had saw in the 800 era. The 800s were shit. And I thought, whoa, hang on a sec.
Yeah.
You know, Laguna Seca 2008, Catalina 2009. Did I mention I was there? Anyway, you know, there were some good races, but yes, let's keep it objective. For a first viewing, this is pretty damn promising. And yes, I'm a Lorenzo fan, so I'm over the moon that he's won. But the main reason I'm over the moon is it looks like the season will be a race, not just the individual races. Now, this comes back to the point, though, that it wasn't that Casey couldn't manage his tyres and Jorge could, which is why he caught him. Casey, and he's got so much stick from, and I've got to say, particularly the Rossi fans, you know, or, you know, he's always got an excuse. It's either the bike or it's an injury. I think, no. There's always a reason someone can't maintain a pace. Sometimes it's the tyres. Sometimes it's the fuel management system. Sometimes it's, I don't know, heavy shopping that's weighing them down, or it's an injury or a condition that appears. In this case, Casey, he wasn't whinging. He was very honest. He was very upfront. He said, I ran as fast as I could or as hard as I could, but I couldn't hold him off because I just got this really bad arm pump. And someone said to him, well, you know, this is an operation you can have. He said, well, I'd rather not. And he won't say what he's doing, but he said, I believe I can manage it in different ways.
Well, okay,
now, I've seen photos of Nicky Hayden's arms.
Martin, yeah. Let's pause for just a moment.
Sure.
One of the things that certainly led to that, that is not speculation, that is actually reality, is that Casey has a tendency to go out and do four or five laps, set a fast lap, and sit down and go, all right, beat that, boys. He did not do, by his own admission or by his team's admission, and somebody correct me if I'm wrong and feel free to do it, HRC, race simulations on the Bridgestone tires that were used at Qatar. And if you don't do a race simulation on those tires, you don't know. Now, granted, he was dealing with chatter problems all through, even through QP, and I believe they had them settled on warm-up on Sunday morning. But if you're not doing race simulations on the tires you intend to run on, then don't be surprised if you end up with issues that may lean to arm pump. It's not something that's bothered him in the past to some extent, although I do remember a couple of years ago he was complaining about it, and it's something that happens. Sorry, you know, the scars are cool. I think Adriana might even dig him.
Yeah. I know what you're saying. We did have an email from Curtis, whose email address is Klee something or other, so I'm not sure if he's Curtis Klee, but he's a rock climber, and he said that arm pump is something that really hits rock climbers.
Yep.
And he said he used to race as well, and he'd get arm pump, but since he started rock climbing 2 years ago, he's not seen it return on a bike. And he mentions the case you're not running full race simulation. So, yes, training to a degree, but the way I understand arm pump is it's not something you can get rid of. It's something that you can, yeah, obviously fitness helps, but it's the muscles going into spasm, shutting down nerves and particularly blood vessels, which then compound it and it becomes self-reinforcing.
Totally.
And it gets to the stage where you cannot operate a brake lever or a throttle. And apparently, we saw in the email, was it your reply to him where someone said that they couldn't take the brake lever off. The hand clenched. And it wasn't you couldn't put the brakes on. It's once the brakes were on,
you
couldn't release your hand. Was it you? Or was it?
No, I don't think so. But I'm trying to think
who that was. But, you know, and they nearly come to a standstill before they could release it and get around the next corner. But it's something that it does leave. I kind of understand why the people who want to have a go at Casey, because God bless him, I don't understand why, but he seems to attract a lot of venom. People who want to have a go, it's like, well, we had the lactose intolerance, now we've got the arm pump. And I think Well, they've all got to deal with this.
True.
You know, Nicky's had arm pump before. Cal had arm pump when he first came into MotoGP. He said, you would not believe it. But what I found interesting was I was watching the BBC bits on BBC iPlayer, and they this was, you know, the day after the race, and I think it was Azifani was interviewing Casey and said, so what's the difference with the thousands and the 800s? And the one thing he said, yeah, you know, they've got a bit more of, they've got a bit more torque, he said. But one thing he picked out, he said, they're more physical and they're a lot tougher on your arms. And I thought, ooh. Now, he didn't, we know he hasn't run more than, what's the most he ran, 12 laps?
Yeah, I believe 12 at Sepang, right?
Yeah. That's the longest he's done on this size bike.
Mm-hmm.
And if he's identified the fact it's tough on your arms, it does kind of say, well, if you knew there might be an issue, then why didn't you go and see if you could run 22 laps?
When Glassbone Pedrosa can do a race simulation, he really can't be complaining about running an arm pump issue. So, all right. Let's,
so that's something that will develop or not through the season. Yeah, I think the thing with Qatar, it's got a lot of similar type corners, and it's got a lot of straight, hard, you know, hard acceleration, hard brake, sharp corner, straight, whereas the more flowing tracks might not be so much a problem. Stefan Bradl, I think, needs another mention after the QP mention we gave him. Running in sixth for most of the race, then he got hunted down by Hector Barbera, Nicky Hayden, and Alvaro Bautista, and relegated to ninth, but recovered to eighth when Hector Barbera ran off track. I like Bradl. I think he was, yeah, okay, last year we were kind of bigging up Marquez. Well, I was bigging up Marquez, and it was a shame that we didn't get to see the culmination of that fight at the end of the season because of Marquez's injury, which, thank goodness, he seems to have got over. But Bradl's a clever bugger. He reminds me of Eugene Laverty. He seems to be one of those guys who, even in the heat of battle, adrenaline pumping, pulse through the roof, he can think. He's got that extra capacity to consider and think, and, you know, and his consistency is phenomenal. So I think Lucio is going to be quite happy.
Well, I hope so. And he needs something to be happy about, considering how poorly last year went. Colin Edwards, you got to give him credit. And, you know, it's interesting, Martin. I saw him looking decidedly uncomfortable both times, both in QP and post-race, where he was sort of the sideshow Bob in Parc Fermé. And I applaud Dorna and the folks for bringing in the CRT folks. I did get a very interesting email. I forget from which team it was, but they said third in class, and it was from one of the CRT teams. And I'm like, wait a minute. Okay, so you're already dividing the quote-unquote classes.
Isn't this something that the first CRT bike will be scrutineered or goes to Parc Fermé?
Well, that's the first CRT bike definitely goes to Parc Fermé, which they've established. We didn't know about until it occurred this weekend. And great, scrutineer the shit out of it. Colin just, he was kind of looking kind of uncomfortable. I should point out no CRT bikes were lapped. But that being said, there were some CRT bikes that spent some time in the pits. So technically some were lapped. They just were not lapped on course.
Physically. I do think Colin, more than anybody in the CRT, on the CRT bikes, bought credibility for this, what do you call it? It's not series, you know, but for this concept.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
He was less than a second behind, just over a second behind Ben Spies. Now, okay, Ben was having a pretty shitty time because he had an untuned chassis, having binned a couple of bikes over the weekend. Ben's been quite.
Martin, I think you're doing a Martin, which is jumping to conclusions, because this is race one, my friend.
No, yeah. I understand that, but I think the doom mongers need to just press the pause button on the doom.
True, and I agree, and I think what we're going to see is what we should have said from the very beginning, or and the doom mongers, as you say, should have been paying attention to, is that It doesn't suck. It was a brilliant race from start to finish with all of the bikes that were involved. I would have liked to see a little bit more TV coverage of some of the CRT bikes, but it is what it is. We still had a brilliant field. Nobody was in danger. Nobody got lapped at some crazy closing rate. And so,
oh, I tell you what, I did notice though, just thinking about that, you remember, because I know you've spoken about this before, and that the dangerous thing is not so much the fact that you've got particularly slow riders or fast riders, but it's closing speeds.
Right.
It's not top speed of the bike you're on. It's the difference between the bike you're on and the bike the slow guy's on. And during QP, when Lorenzo was his very last or the penultimate lap, one of his flying lap record breaking laps, and James Ellison was on a flying lap, as in he wasn't tootling, he was trying to go. And the speed that Lorenzo went past him was frightening. And it did make me think, okay, shit. I mean, but some of these guys are 30 kilometers an hour down on faster pikes.
But the point being is that's only on the straights, Martin. They're the same speed in the corners. They're the exact same speed in the corners.
Yeah.
For the most part. The speed difference has really nothing to do with corner speed because the bike, well, not nothing, but I mean, it's minute compared to what you're talking about percentage wise on the straights.
Sure.
Okay.
We haven't mentioned, well, we've mentioned, but we haven't talked about where do we start, Valentino?
Oh, you know, I'm not even sure if I want to go there because that would be another hour in the show.
Well, briefly, the facts were he qualified 12th. He got up to 10th in the race, having had a not particularly good start. He was got up to 10th, and he was blocked by Hector Barbera coming past him, bit of a block pass, dropped back to 12th, then made it back up to 10th by passing the struggling Ben Spies, and then picked up one other place when Carol Abraham retired. And that was it. That's where he stayed. And he came home as the third and last Ducati, the last surviving Ducati. Lots of range of reactions from fans and pundits. Some people saying, will he see out the season if things don't improve or retire, whatever. Neil Spaulding, we've already mentioned, one spike setup was as per free practice in QP, this was, and the other setup was Nicky's, and that's the one he chose to ride in the race. It clearly didn't work. And he said with a new rear tire in, the rear was pushing the front so much, he couldn't trust the front. And Valentino came out with this, I think, slightly disingenuous comment that if Barbera hadn't punted him off, he would have been in the top six. And I've looked at his lap. I've looked at the lap times, and I can't see anything. I can't see what he's basing that on. I think that's ridiculously optimistic. I think he'd have been ninth or tenth. If he'd been, he was tenth. He got punted off, went back to 12th. Got back up to 10th.
My intention is to wait until after Jerez to evaluate what Rossi's issues are. But to be honest, I think somehow they fucked up at Qatar.
Yeah.
And they're going to take the time between now and then to fix it. Now, if the same thing happens at Jerez, then I will turn on the afterburners. But for right now, I'm going to say.
But what gets me is this is the rider that set the world alight, being able to ride around problems, being adaptable. He went from 500s to 990s to 800s. You know, he was the guy who could just, you could give him a bloody bicycle with a lawnmower engine on it, and he'd make it somehow go quicker.
Yeah, but you're basing you and almost everybody else out there, basing your observations on what you admittedly were talking about before was two very different types of motorcycles. And he chose one and it didn't work for him.
Yeah.
Whether if he'd chosen the other one and it didn't work for him, we'll never know. And until we see what.
But the other one hadn't worked for him during free and qualifying.
But we don't know in a race situation, do we?
No.
Until you see what they can pull it. Now, if you see a sequential series of poor results, I'll be the first to say, Ballet needs to go to WRC. But
does he need the break? No, it doesn't. I absolutely agree. But last season was an entire season, and that did make a season. And he had an appalling season last season. And I've put in here, is it recoverable or is his star really in decline? But we won't know until they build him a bike that he's happy on. We won't know if it's him or the bike. Because I've got to be honest at the moment, and I might be shot down for saying this because we can't prove it because it ain't going to happen. You stick him back on an M1, Lorenzo's going to beat him in 8 races out of 10. I would put a large amount of money down on that because I think Casey Stoner, Jorge Lorenzo, and on most days, Danny Pedrosa are faster than Valentino now. Which brings us back to the original first kickoff I had with Big John Hart. There you go. John, you got your mention. Yes, you can be the greatest of all time, but you can't be the greatest for all time. And I think you've had all these people going, he can't be past it. Look at Bayliss, Checker, Biaggi. I'm sorry. You listen to Cal Crutzlow's interview that I did with him at Silverstone last year, and where he said how incredibly physical the MotoGP bikes are compared to World Superbikes. Yes, you can nearly go as fast on a World Superbike, he said, but they don't compare. If they did, Checker and Biaggi would be back in MotoGP running at the front. Funny old thing, they're not. They were past it when they left. They're doing really well in World Superbikes. If Valentino goes to World Superbikes, I have no doubt he'd be champion most years, probably for another 5 or 6 years. I don't know.
Could be. I don't know. But we'll never know. But my point, very seriously, being making a judgment call from a single race, especially with such a dynamic change to what Ducati has done over winter, is a fool's game.
Yeah, and, no, I completely agree with you. Yeah. But not when it comes on the back. Well, no, I do agree with you, because I just contradicted myself then. I do agree with you to a degree. But this is a continuation of the decline that we saw last – well, not decline, but the disaster we saw last year.
Bullshit, because you saw Nicky have a good result. So if Nicky
exactly
can do it,
exactly, that reinforces my point. It's not necessarily the bike in isolation, because for God's sake, we saw Casey Stoner win a title and win a shitload of races on that bike.
No, on a completely different motorcycle.
Sorry, for this year, yes, but not from last year's.
Right.
Well, not from last year's at the beginning of last year. And Casey's point has been he would go back to Ducati and say, that thing's bloody dangerous. It's trying to kill me. It's trying to bite me head off. You need to change it. And their answer all the time was, you're winning. What's the problem?
All right. This is when I put my boss hat on and I say, we're going to move on.
Yeah, fair point. Because that rate's going to go and go and go until he goes to Formula One or World Championship.
Yeah, you and I will turn into a verbal version of Crash, and I'm not going to do that.
No. Fair enough.
All right. Let me look at what we got here.
We need to do a listener's poll. We need to get a poll up on the website, and we can say, you know.
We can do that. all right. Well, Martin, I think I'm basically exhausted talking about MotoGP.
I want the next one. I want her rest now.
Well, you know, we'll have it soon enough. And frankly, I think all of those boys, it's always funny because as much as I would love to be able to get interviews with guys after the Qatar race, everybody scatters to the four winds and there's no way that you can get them. And so the interviews that we have had this week or have this week, I think are fantastic, which means I think it's time to throw another one in. And that means that we got a killer interview that I just did just prior to you and I talking this evening, your time, with Chris Walker. So let's go ahead and roll that now. This is Jim Race here for Motopod with Chris Walker, who apparently James Whittam has stamped you with the term the stalker, which I think is funny.
I owe a lot to that guy, to be fair. Not all of it good.
In many ways. You know, as one of the things that I do, of course, when I'm talking to a racer that I haven't talked to before, is kind of run down through their past and I've followed your career over time and kind of always wondered how you always managed to have a ride, but you have probably ridden, I would say by far, of all the racers that I've talked to, the most diverse set of motorcycles and brands of anybody that I've ever talked to.
Really? I mean, I've been around a while, I guess that helps with that, but no, there's not a lot I've not sat on over the years, that's for sure.
Well, and not only that, but not only brands and series. I mean, you know, I don't see an envy of Goose in there, but, you know, Suzuki, Yamaha, Kawasaki, Honda's, Petronas, which must have been fun. You've been all over the map, sir, and you've been in every series, and now you are back in British Superbike. But kind of give me a little rundown on your past. How did you, without going through each year, how did you find yourself in bouncing around like that?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I think a little bit of it was because of my age. When I started racing, I wasn't a teenager. I was a motocross rider from being a kid and switched to road racing. And by the time I started road racing, I was already, you know, nudging in my mid-20s. Yeah. So it kind of, because people at that stage were already looking at the real young riders to become tomorrow's stars, you kind of got sent down different paths because of where eyes were open to you, because you kind of get categorized, really. I was almost a vet when I started. But having said that, I have had chances on Grand Prix bikes, World Superbikes, even World Supersport, so it's not really held me back. But at the same time, it didn't give me that kind of... I couldn't take my time, a bit like, for argument's sake, Cal Crutchlow. He's kind of did British Supersport, British Superbike, went into the World Supersport, and he's kind of just took a plod along and done planned the whole route out, because he was doing it from being 15 years of age, whereas I was 7 or 8 years beyond that, so I hadn't really got time. I just kind of, where there was a ride, I had to grab it, snatch it, and if it took me suddenly in a different direction, that's kind of why I ended up where I was.
Part of the part that really I find interesting, and I agree with you on starting young, because I certainly didn't myself. If I had, I think I would be a phenom, but of course I didn't. I waited too long. But I mean, you started racing in 95. Your motocross career, did you wrap up any titles? You a schoolboy winner or what?
I was basically in the UK, there's the big ACU champion, the yep. British Championships, and then there's the amateur version of it, the AMCA, and I was an AMCA front runner.
Okay. All right. Started racing in 95, mostly early years, British Superbike, but the thing that kind of intrigues me was the time that you spent an initial big jump into the pond in 2001, which was crazy, on a Shell-sponsored Honda. And that was a bit of a handful, wasn't it, sir?
Oh, yeah, it really was. I mean, my background was two-strokes, really. I'd raced two-stroke motocross bikes the whole time I raced those, and then started on RGV 250, went to 250 Honda, so it's not like I'd not ridden a two-stroke, but I think the problem for me was I then became a superbike rider, 4 years riding four-strokes, and learned how to do that quite well compared to what I've achieved on two-strokes. And when I tried to make the switch back, it was at a time, you know, just before MotoGP became four-stroke, and when the 500s were, I guess, as powerful as it's ever been. And I couldn't believe what a transition it was from back to a superbike, four-stroke, to a two-stroke, learning new tracks, learning new tyres, carbon brakes, and trying to learn a two-stroke, and with a foreign team. And it was all, I mean, I was still relatively inexperienced at the time. I've got 5 years of racing under my belt, and has got a full-on factory 500 ride with a team, actually, that didn't have the best budget in the world. So every time he fell off it, they make me get reminded of how much it was costing him, which isn't ideal for your confidence.
the Shell-sponsored team, where were they based out of?
They were based in Spain. Okay. Based speakers in Spain, not a million miles from where Kenny Roberts was based at the time. I mean, I have to say, the bike was an immense piece of kit. You know, it was an ex Alex Crivier bike from the year before, actually, that he didn't do very well, to be honest. And the bike was a bit of a weapon, but I genuinely didn't gel with it like I'd hoped I would. And the step from essentially British Superbikes to 500 Grand Prix was immense. And you look at the route the other guys have taken since, on and won world championships, whether that be Mick Hodgson or Toseland or Cal Kushler, they've won world championships, super sport or superbike, and then gone to GP. And you know, not obviously Cal because he's doing a great job, but the other guys struggled to make the mark. And I tried to do that coming straight after the British Championship. So, to be honest, it was always going to be a bit of an uphill struggle. And I remember by the end of the season, well, by halfway through the season, I'd fallen off the bike that many times, walking from the back of the garage to get onto the bike at the front of the garage. It felt like walking the plank. You really didn't know what was going to happen to you next. It was a savage old beast it was.
Oh, I know that feeling. I do know that feeling. So you soldiered your way through that year. Next year, you moved over to World Superbike, initially with the Fuchs Kawasaki. Was that an Eckel team back then?
Yeah, it was Howard Eckel. It was actually his last year with the Kawasaki team. And I have to say, my World Superbike kind of career, is, if you want a better word, was fraught with things happening to me. Like, whoever I signed for, it tended to be their last year. So I didn't get any choice but to have to move teams. And I think at that level, it's so nice if you get a bit of continuity and the luxury of riding the same bike year on year, a bit like Bayliss and the boys have achieved over time. And right. I rode Howard Eckel on the 750 Kawasaki just as the 750s were being phased out.
Right.
I was the first four-cylinder that year, but I was about ninth, eighth or ninth in the championship. But then was really fortunate that the next year I signed for JC Ducati. Right. And rode, to be honest, it's probably the best bike I've ever raced. It was an ex-Ruben Zaus factory Ducati in 03, so it'd be a 2002 996, and it was just incredible, the bike was. And I had more podiums that year and even got on the Rostrum at Laguna Seca on that bike. It was, you know, it was a peach of a thing, it really was. And it was a flattering bike, I think Ducatis have been over the years, really. And I jumped on it and was instantly more competitive than I'd been ever before and ever since, really.
I'll have you know that I was corner marshaling turn two when you got on the podium.
Yeah.
In turn two. And that was a great run for you there.
I can assure you the prize money didn't last long. Me and Mark Eccles, who was also in the same race, we did the long trip straight from there to LA and blew it all on Sunset Boulevard.
Which is not hard to do. It's a good thing you didn't go to Vegas, because these days it seems like now that World Superbike's coming to MMP at Utah, all the boys head straight from Utah to Vegas, and I'm pretty sure that they all end up driving or flying home broke.
Yeah, you're not wrong.
But you've had an absolutely brilliant succession of teammates over the years, and I mean the names, you know, they all stand out to me. You know, well, you had Foggy, of course. You worked for him, which must have been a treat, I bet.
Oh, it was great. I think the world of him, I really do. He was I don't think he's everybody's cup of tea, but that's probably because they don't understand him. You know, he's actually quite shy. He comes across to some people as they'd say he's arrogant, but he's anything but, really, when you get to know him. And he was great to have there as a more of as a mentor, as much as a mentor, really, as a team owner stroke manager. But great guy, a lot of fun. He knew his bike wasn't the best bike out there, but he threw everything and the kitchen sink at it to try and make it competitive for you, because he knows as a racer at the level that he was at that there's nothing more frustrating than your bike being under par. And I mean, the only reason I didn't re-sign for them for a second year was purely because I wanted to be on a machine that I'd got a chance of, you know, being competitive on. And the bike really was, it just, the rules had changed. It was a 900, you could suddenly race thousands. And Foggy kind of, he was disappointed that I'd left, but at the same time, as a racer, he could understand why we moved on to, you know.
Yep.
Oh,
did I lose you? Hold on. Let's see if we come back. Are you there?
Yeah.
Okay, that occasionally happens. Occasionally we'll have a little blip. I'll edit that out. So I get it. I mean, Foggy would be unhappy that you would leave, but and it is very cool that he, as a former racer, respected that. You know, there's times when and I agree with you. There's a lot of people that kind of look at Foggy and go, oh, he's an arrogant bastard. And there's a lot of people that look at Foggy and go, okay, he's a very calculated individual. I tend to think of him as the latter.
Yeah, without a doubt. And he's a family guy as well. You know, he's just a normal, You know, I see him motocrossing now occasionally, and he's around a bit with Ducati still, doing some bits and bobs with their single make series in the UK and stuff. And I think he's more into motorbikes now than he was when he was actually racing one. I think he never made it a secret that the fact that he liked winning more than he liked motorbikes, if you know what I mean. But now he's not racing anymore, so the winning's out of it. He's enjoying the bikes more, and I think that really comes across when you see him now. He's got some old, not twin shot motocross bikes, but the Evo spec ones from the mid 80s and stuff. Him and Whittam actually is his right hand man. They've been and bought some ones that were shipped in from the States, I think, some real Megatrick mid 80s Hondas and Yamahas to race and stuff like that. And I'll hopefully get out, because I do a bit of that as well myself, so hopefully get out and race with them later on this year for a bit of fun. So that'd be great.
Well, you know, and I hear tell that Whittam is building up a two-stroke bike too. Are you boys planning on doing like the retired club series or what? What's going on here?
I'm still racing. Don't include me.
Okay, sorry.
Because my background was motocross, I've never really stopped doing the odd race here and there, the Western Beach race, the odd motocross club race locally and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But I've got an involvement with a motocross track now, and of course it's amazing how many friends you suddenly get when they know they can come and ride a motocross bike for free somewhere, as opposed to having to go and pay a few dollars up the road. So it's enhanced my popularity, if nothing else. But I did a bit of twin shock racing on an old little Suzuki RM125 a couple of years ago. I had lots of fun with it, and it's something that I'm not intending to stop superbiking just yet, but when the day finally comes, I'd like to do a few, old school races, both, on the tarmac and on the dirt. I think it'd be a lot of fun and kind of keep me sane, really. After so many years of racing, it'd be hard to just stop it altogether when the time comes.
Yeah, it's very difficult to step off, and in fact, I've got the itch real bad right now, frankly. back to Superbike in 2017, up with Cal Crutchlow on the Rizla Suzuki, which was not a bad bike. Actually, it was a pretty damn good bike. Was that under Jack Valentine?
Yeah, Jack Valentine. No, actually, that year was Simon Buckmaster.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, Jack actually came in at the end of that year. Simon went off and got the Park Algar deal for the World Super Sport.
Sure.
And, to be honest, the bike was good, team was good, everything. For me, it was a bit of a baptism of fire after a few years on Pirelli tyres and coming back to BSB to what felt like goat tracks, really, after racing around fantastic circuits that you do in the World Series, like Monza or Phillip Island and all those. But, I enjoyed this season, took to it quite well. And to be honest, that kind of it made me realise that, BSB's where I want to be, when the world deal finishes, BSB's what I wanted to do. Some of the guys take the World Endurance route or go off and do the Italian Championship and things. But I thoroughly enjoyed being back at home. Enjoyed the fact that, I was that year, I actually got married as well that year, and it was a nice change to be kind of, you leave home on a Thursday morning, you're back home on a Sunday night, and it kind of left time for other things as well.
And you don't have to make your own dinner.
No, exactly. So, but I enjoyed my time there, and the bike, as you said, the bike was good. And to race in the Rizla colours was, for me, was a bit special, with them.
Oh, yeah.
Sponsoring the MotoGP team and things. It was just a bit of a kudos about it that even now, I'm sat here in my office now and I've got my Rizla helmet outside of me and stuff. It's a mega deal, and I'm hoping they'll be back next year with Suzuki and MotoGP and some guys, eh?
You, me, and the rest of the paddock watchers. Well, I know they said 2014 for sure, but 2013, we'll have to see.
Yeah, I think secretly they're waiting in the wings for all the rules to get sorted, because I agree.
Now
a few of the lower budget Japanese manufacturers or people, wanting to get into that paddock, they really do need to find, there's no point in trying to develop something for it to find out 12 months later it's going to be bin fodder, and they just haven't got the budget to do that. And I think they are sitting on the fence, as are a couple of other manufacturers, just waiting for MotoGP to see which way it ends up going. Because, I love what they've done with it. More bikes on the grid, this and the other. But it is really two races in one, and it needs to be one race again, doesn't it, at some stage? So.
Yep. Especially when you have it was much like last year in BSB with the Superbikes and the Evo.
Yeah, exactly. It's even more of a difference, really.
Yeah. Because we had Evo guys, actually. Was it Kirkham that got on the box, I think, in one of the finals?
Yeah, I think Gowan was up there. He was on fire last year. He did brilliantly.
Yeah. All right, so out of BSB in 2007, off to World Superbike in 2008, you had the coolest teammate on the planet, I think. Katsuhashi Fujiwara.
Fujiwara, he was ace.
Yeah,
he is so cool. He's so laid back. He's horizontal. He's mega. But the Japanese guys are. I mean, I had a Japanese teammate in 2001 with Izutsu at Kawasaki. Yeah. I mean, I genuinely feel blessed for some of the teammates that I've had over the years. You know, we didn't mention Neil McKenzie,
right.
Harry Reimer, James Toseland. The list goes on and on, really. And actually, although they weren't teammates, the two guys that I've kind of battled tooth and nail to the British Championship, they won it. I finished second. It was Troy Bayliss and Neil Hodgson. So I've had kind of a couple of absolute legends for your kind of arch enemies for the year, for your nemesis as such, and I've had some amazing teammates, and I have to say that Fuji was special. He didn't talk lots, but he didn't need to, just the expressions, and when you sit and listen to his debrief with his mechanic, how on earth he ever got a setup on the bike, I'll never know, because it was all sign language, French-speaking team and a non-English-speaking Japanese guy, real funny, but I did like him a lot. He wore a different pair of shades every time you saw him.
And the man has a smile that can stretch across continents.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he's great. And fast. Still fast now, you know.
Oh, yeah. Amazingly enough. You kind of bopped around there a bit, switched over to Paul Bird for a bit, who is moving himself. You never know where he's going to land these days. You ended up back in BSB, and that's where you've been today, right, sir?
Yeah, that's where I've been ever since, yeah. And I'm having a great time there. I really am. I think it's for a domestic series, it's as good as it gets. It really
is.
The crowds are huge. The following is massive. We get, you know, TV coverage globally, which is great for the championship. The series organisers, they're the first with new ideas for all sorts of things. And, you know, it is a great championship to be a part of. And also, for me, it's on my doorstep. And right. It's about as international as a domestic series can be with all the riders that we've got from overseas. You know, we've had Americans, Australians, New Zealanders, you know, Japanese, you name it, we've had it over the last few years. And this year we've had an influx of, you know, World Superbike paddock guys coming to us to add to it again. And also now we're stretching legs and going overseas for a race as well at Assen. So who knows, it'll probably become the European Championship in a year or two, but it'll probably be long gone by then. But you know, fair play to them, and they do a great job, really.
You watch Dornier in front will go, no, I'm sorry, you cannot travel this far. No Spanish races.
Yeah, they've got enough races in Spain as it is, I think.
Exactly. Okay, then I have to ask, and I do ask this of most BSB riders, most favorite and least favorite BSB track?
Well, my favorite's Donington, without a doubt.
Right.
We don't go there very often, and we had a spell where we didn't go there for a year or two, but it's back on the calendar, and I absolutely love the place. And it is it's probably my most local circuit as well, which is great, because you get a few extra. Well, your day's a nightmare, actually, because everybody that you know wants a ticket because it's on the doorstep. But it's nice because you get that bit of extra support when it's local.
Am I going to guess Knockhill for your least?
I like Knockhill. I really do. It's a good little track. I really don't mind the smaller circuits. I've always been a fan of Mallory. It's not on the calendar now, but I loved it there. It's where I've had my first ever race. It's where I first got my knee down on tarmac. You know, I've got lots of fond memories of those places. But
and we will talk about Mallory in a bit. You know that.
I think the UK, for me, Croft was my most disliked track, and it's not on the calendar this year, so I've had a right result.
Right on.
Yeah, and again, it was an enjoyable race meeting to be a part of, because we don't go to that part of the country very often, so the spectators were, you know, they were very knowledgeable, didn't see you very often, made a big fuss of everybody for being there. But the track itself was bumpy and surface wasn't great, and it always rained. I know it rains in the UK a lot, but it rains there every single day, I'm sure it does.
Well, I guess this is the point where we actually talk about rain, because you just got back from Brands Hatch running the Indy circuit, which isn't my favorite configuration, but some of the riders seem to enjoy it. It was a bit of a miserable Monday, wasn't it, sir?
It was, yeah. I mean, it's such a shame, because we were there for 4 days with me in the first round. They put an extra test day on that. They have the final test of the off-season the day before. and, you know, all the new bikes, the new liveries, new paintwork, new leathers, new helmets, and I don't think there was many people came away from the weekend without scratching at least something because the weather was so dire. And I mean, it started out good. Us as a team, we were right on the pace, really in the dry, and just struggled in the wet, which is, it's, to be honest, it's normally the other way around for me. Normally the little privateer teams struggle a bit against the big teams in the dry, and you kind of come into your own in the wet, a bit less power, and things kind of plays to your hand a little bit. But it seemed the other way around at Brands for me this time. But it was such a shame. It ended up cancelling a race as well because of oil and stuff on the track. So it wasn't the best opening round. It wasn't the worst. We've had a cancellation for snow and completely wrote the whole route.
I remember that. Great photos from that, though.
So it's not the worst start of the season it's ever been, but it certainly, I think it'll be more like the start part two at Thruxton this weekend because we leave to go there tomorrow. So we've got, you know, back-to-back races.
It was very, yeah, and you are headed off to Thruxton in a day or so. It was interesting looking at qualifying times because Q1, you had a damn good Q1, but as we wandered into Q2 and Q3, the times kept raising and raising, you know, by the point where, and I'm assuming that was because of weather, they were like 6 seconds slower in Q3 than they were in Q1.
Yeah, I mean, it's... You know, over the weekend, I don't know whether I should say it, but I've got form for peaking too soon. I have, and I knew after that weekend, we went out for the first practice of the weekend. I was 10th. Second practice, I was 8th. Third practice, I was 8th. Fourth practice, I was 10th. Then it was pre-qualifying. I was fastest, and you know, I remember looking at my wife when I came in, and I said to her, "We really need to do this this afternoon."
Yeah.
And then, of course, as always, we went out for qualifying, did pretty good in the first one, and then the weather started, the rain started, and it was just damp, patchy, and then it rained properly. And I think a lot of the people got caught out, really. It was, you know, you couldn't have a setup for every one of those scenarios. You didn't necessarily have all the tyres on your rims and the discs and everything ready for all those scenarios. And we were a team that fell foul to that, and there's a few others out there as well, which is why the likes of, you know, people that should have been way up the grid, like your Tommy Hills and things, were right at the back because they just had a torrid time. And yeah. The trouble is, as you know now, even at a BSB level, the times are that close. I think there was 1 second in the first 20 before qualifying when the conditions were all stable. So if you're coming off the fourth and fifth row of the grid and you're only half a second faster than the guys in front on such a little track like that, it takes some pulling through. So once you've had a tough qualifying, it is a downer on your weekend. And I think that's really what kind of cost Tommy, really. He knew he'd got to get his head down, get through the pack, and get a good lap time for the next race for qualifying. And, of course, you make more mistakes, don't you, when you're rushing through. So, yeah, yeah. The older championship favourites, I would say, didn't have the best of weekends. For me, people asked before the weekend who I thought the top three were going to be, and you know, you always, you know, you're told not to include yourself, and I don't know whether I would rightly or wrongly at this stage of my career anyway, but my pick for the three really was Laverty for first, Tommy Hill for second, and then third was a toss-up, I think, between Brooksy and Harker, depending how Harker took to the BSB series. And when you look at how those guys went, Brooksy ran off the track, Tommy crashed, Laverty crashed, and Harger, I beat Harger. So you just think none of the guys that you actually thought were going to be leading at this stage were anywhere in the race. So it's going to be wide open at the next one, that's for sure.
Yeah, no doubt. And we'd be doing a disservice if we didn't mention your team. This is Primo Bournemouth Kawasaki Racing, right?
Yeah, that's right, Bournemouth Kawasaki Racing. It's the same team I rode for last year, but in essence, but it is a different team owner. And they joined forces with Bournemouth Kawasaki with this new two-man team thing for 2012. And it's great. It's the team stepped up a level. The bike I'm riding, although it's a Kawasaki and the same kind of bike as last year, it is a different machine and a better one. So I've had a result, really. I've ended up with a better bike and a better team than last year, but running in the same colours. So it's a bit of continuity. It lasts a bit late in my career, but finally got a little bit.
Well, and there's no doubt that Hillier is a pretty cool teammate to have, too.
I mean, any of those guys who do the TT, they're just, yeah. You know, there's obviously something missing, but he's here.
No doubt. Frankly, that makes for a great teammate because you never know what kind of shit's going to come out of their mouth. You're like, I'm sorry, what did you say? And as you mentioned, you did finish in one in front of one Orihaga. You got to kind of considering the way that the weekend went. That's got to be a little bit of a notch in your belt. Did you wander over and say hello?
Yeah, I actually pulled up in the park fairway next to him after the race, and I looked across and smiled, and he had the biggest grin, and he just shook his head. He didn't need to say anything. I think that was his BSB, baptism of fire. It was spoken with just a shake of a head and a smile. I think it was. I don't think anybody could believe how slippy the track was, and I think after Tommy had been off in qualifying and in the race, and Norrie had struggled a little bit through the practices, I think he was just glad to get a finish, to be honest. And actually, with that race being on the Monday and Thruxton being this weekend, by the time you get home, you've literally got 2 days of prep on the bikes and then straight to the next race. And I think that's what must have been on the organisers' mind when they actually decided to cancel the second race after the oil spillage. They must have thought, well, these guys have only got 2 days to get ready. And half the super sport field had been wiped out, hadn't it? And they'd already got plenty of work to do without those guys doing it too.
Yeah, there's a lot of painters and fiberglass manufacturers that are very, very busy right now.
Yeah, you're not wrong. my leather sponsor, RST, they produced for the third round VSB 67 individual sets of leathers for different riders and teams up and down the paddock.
Oh, man.
And I think they've had nearly half of them back to repair this week.
I
was there today with a pair of my own.
if I'm in the UK and I actually remember how to sew, I know where to go for a temporary job, right?
Yeah.
Thruxton, you get on well there?
Yeah, I've had some results there in the past. I've had some, you know, I think all the tracks I've had good and bad times, but I don't dislike any of them really. And Thruxton is what is good is it's wide open. You know, we've got my bike this year, despite the new rules, it's the most powerful bike I've ever sat on. We dynoed it just before Brands, and it was 222.8 brake horsepower on the back wheel with 95.8 foot-pounds of torque. And it's going to be special around Thruxton, that's for sure. It was a bit of a handful of Brands, especially in the wet. But the new rules haven't slowed the Kawasaki's down. Mine's, but it's the fastest thing I've ever sat on. So, I mean, I know there's other fast bikes out there, but it's going to be, you know, there's fifth gear corners at Thruxton, let alone the straights. So, yeah, I'm excited about it.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's for the last, oh, Christ, I don't know, 8 years, the ZX-10 has always had a handful of power, more than most people could cope with, but it's had a chassis that wasn't quite up to par with the engine, and now the thing is dialed in. We can see what Sykes is doing with it in World Superbike, and it seems like that's also filtering down to the national level as well.
Yeah, it's coming good. It really is. I mean, my bike is an ex-Paul Bird bike from last year that was built for Michael Dunlop to contest the TTN and stuff, so it wasn't the World Superbike spec bike, but it was built by proper people with the right bits on it in the right places. And the bike I rode last year, I genuinely felt was special at the time, but having sat on this one, the few little minor things that are done differently on it make a big difference, and especially over a race distance. So I'm looking forward to a dry race at some stage so we can actually find out what it's all about, really. But no, the Kawasaki's have come good, they really have, and I feel, you know, lucky really that I've kind of, despite having ridden virtually everything, you know, under the sun, I have spent more time on a Kawasaki than anything, and I've got a great relationship with the guys there, and it definitely helps when you're in a domestic series and you need a bit of a leg up now and then.
Well, I am an absolute Team Green rider and fan from the past too, so I'm right there with you, my friend. Hey, let's talk about something very cool that you've put together, which is the Chris Walker Race School. And we mentioned Mallory Park before, where you first got your knee down. You've got a cool little school going on, dude.
Yeah, that's right. New for 2012. I mean, I'm under no illusion that despite the fact I'd really like to race forever, I can't race forever. And, you know, I want to still be involved in the sport. I'd love to put a bit of something back into the sport. And we've come with the concept of something a bit different to what's not been done before. There's been plenty of schools over the years. There's still a couple of very successful ones in the UK, the California Superbike School and also Ron Aslam Race School. But they've been around a while, successful. But ultimately, you know, one's a very school orientated. The other one's more of a kind of day out experience on a racetrack. Whereas ours, it's a race school, but it's got a BSB type feel about it. The day starts with a warm up. You get free practice 1, 2, and 3. You get a super pole style qualifying lap time.
Actually,
really special.
I'm just going to stop you. As soon as I read Umbrella Girls, I'm like, I'm flying over.
Yeah, there's at least four of those every one. So yeah, we've rocked out the Frolly Girls. Yeah, we've got massive support from Maxis and the Maxis Girls, the Maxis Babes, in England. Mm-hmm. They're a brand all to themselves in the UK, and they're every round. We've got two of the Maxis Babes, and we've also got the Chris Walker Race Corps Babes as well. And Maxis, I don't know whether not everybody's aware, but they've got a new sports radio tire out that they've like branched into a new market. They're on top of the world really when it comes to scooter tires, mid-range car type tires, and also push bike tires. I think they're the biggest manufacturer out there. But the sports bike side of things, they're still kind of treading water and been gradually introducing new stuff, and they've got finally got a new sports radio out there that they want people to realise how good it is. And so they're providing the tyres for our race school, which will ultimately get somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000 people through a year. And they're all going to sample what these new Maxis tyres are like, which is what I've been doing actually until about 7 o'clock this evening before I'm pushed back to talk to you, because we were at Maxis doing the final testing on what sort of pressures we're going to run on the school bikes and things, because the first school date is actually next week, April the 19th, the first one. So.
So in the first school, and so I remember back in 2003, I ran in Northern California a new racer school for the largest track day provider here. And I remember in the very days leading up to the first new racer school, how nervous I felt. And I bet you've got a little bit of those nerves yourself.
Oh, yeah. Well, the thing is, I'm now the proud owner of 35 Kawasaki ZX6Rs, which as of today are all like brand new without a mark on them, and I've got a feeling this time next week that probably won't be the same case. So I'm a little bit nervous, I have to say, but I've got some. What is good about the school is despite the fact that we want people to go out there, have fun and ride a bike, and find the limits sort of thing, we've got there's 10 instructors plus myself, all straight out of the BSB arena. Dan Linfoot, Gary Mason, we've got Barry Boyle of the BMW rider. We've got Dave Johnson, who set pole in the Super Stock of the weekend. It's like we've got Westy, James Westmoreland. All the instructors are straight out of BSB. They're all the guys that everybody knows. And they're there to keep everybody safe. So despite the fact that we've got free practices and qualifying and lap times, so they're now faster than anything, there is a big element of control about it. So they can have a lot of fun, but in a controlled environment, and kind of test the limits of a bike that ultimately they don't own. So heaven forbid they do fall off it, apart from getting an early bath, it's not going to really cost them a great deal. So no, it's going to be great fun, and I can't wait for it all to kick off. And Kawasaki have embraced it hugely, because I think the ZX6R, there couldn't be a better bike for it really. And I don't know what £300 equates to in dollars at the moment. I don't know what the exchange rate is, but it's a big day out for £300 in England. That's for certain.
Probably about $425 in USD. I remember I did my first track day was with California Superbike School back in, and if I remember correctly, it was more than that. But that was back when we didn't have track days. Track days in California now and in the States, you can't swing a dead cat without running over one. They're everywhere. A question for you. I'm assuming that you have a deposit requirement for the bikes, but are you also running lap timers on them?
They're not actually running lap timers. I'm actually physically on the bikes, but what we've got is we've got live timing. So although the guys won't know when they're going round, how fast they're going, they'll get a timesheet at the end of each session.
Which I think is actually better, because then they don't focus on their lap time so much as their lines.
Yeah, exactly. And it's something that you hear of people going to other schools and they say, I didn't learn anything. But we'll physically be able to prove that how fast you were from when you started to what you were like at the end, where you picked up time, where you can make some improvement. You'll be scored on that, marked on that. There's trophies for the fastest guys. There's trophies for the most improved. There'll be a Walker wild card for somebody that I think, they may not have been the fastest on the day or been the biggest improver, but you can tell they've really taken something away from it. And, we're going to make it a special day out for people. And ultimately, it would be really great if we could find one of tomorrow's stars from it as well.
Yeah, cool.
And what we're doing over the year is each of the schools, there's 20 school dates, and there's two schools a day that kind of cross over in the middle of the day sort of thing. So we'll find the fastest one from each of those schools, invite them back to a special one at the end of the year, and the fastest guy from it we're going to put into a race the following year. And put them in the race of the year at Mallory Park, see how they get on, and who knows from there what it might lead to. So no, exciting times, it really is.
Cool. Did you say 35 ZX6Rs?
Yeah.
Dude. okay. How many? That I'm assuming you got. How many spare sets of bodywork have you got?
Oh yeah, plenty.
Okay.
We've got four or five spare bikes and double that in bodywork and parts. But no, I mean there is an element of that. You know, at motorcycles, they don't stand up without moving forward, without a stand down, do they? So you know, you've got to be able to ride one to be a part of it. It's not a school for the absolute beginner, but we do cater for inexperienced, for young, for old, and we've got loads of ladies booked on as well as guys that are just starting out club racing too. So you know, we do cater for everybody, and the instructors, you know, some like to go with a fast guy, some prefer to go with somebody that needs more kind of that needs a different kind of instruction, and you know, we cater for it all. And the bike, I believe, is a really good little bike for instruction, because they're ever so agile, the brakes are superb, the tyres are super sticky. Mallory isn't a long circuit, so they'll do lots and lots of laps around there. So whatever somebody tries to teaches you, you'll have at least another 30 or 40 laps after that. I think they'll get in 60 or 70 laps over the day, depending how fast they are. So they're going to have plenty of laps to at least put into practice what you've been taught, and I think that's a big bonus with using a circuit that's a shorter lap like at Mallory Park.
Cool. All right. As usual with most of my guests, I keep them long, far longer than I ever intended to, and far longer than they probably ever thought they would be on. I've had a great time talking with you, Chris. I wish you best of luck at Thruxton this weekend. I wish you best of luck with your school, and let's pray for some dry weather, my friend.
No, thank you, and make sure you look us up if you come over to the UK and you can have a day at this Chris Walker Race School.
I'll be over there for the TT, so let's see if I can.
There you go. Make sure you get over and come and see us, and you'll be pleased to know that young Mr. Whitten's does a few of the briefings on the day as well, so you'll get to see a few of your pals too.
Yeah, well, James and I have a love-hate relationship. But
his wife's got one of them with him, too, so you're not the only one.
okay, and so the question that, because I told you before the call that I was texting with him, and I said, James, give me a question to ask him, and it was a great question. So here is the question before I let you go.
I'm good in this.
No, it was nice. It wasn't classic James. It was a nice question. He said, do you still love racing as much as you did when you started? And he said, I think that he does, but I want to hear his answer.
His question was, do I still love racing as much as I started?
Do you still love racing as much as you did when you started?
To be honest, genuinely from the heart, I'm enjoying it more now than I ever have.
Yeah?
Yeah, and I think because I'm at a point in my career where I've not necessarily got anything to prove. I don't ride for one of the teams with the big pressure on, like a Samsung, Honda, or a Crescent Suzuki anymore. I ride for a tight knit little privateer team where everybody's kind of on the same side and not got any agendas in it. It's just a really special place to be at a weekend. And you jump on these bikes now, and they're just such an absolute piece of kit. It's hard to describe how special my little Kawasaki is that I race this year. It's incredible. And the first time I tested it only a couple of weeks ago, the first thing I thought as I went down the back straight, I thought, I'm glad I'm doing this for another year. You know what I mean? And that's it for me. I just love motorbikes, and I'm a motorbike fan. I like motorbike people, and I don't think that'll ever change.
Cool. All right. Well, listen, you take care. Thank you so much for joining us on Motopod, and I look forward to seeing what kind of results you can pull out of Thruxton, sir.
Hey, thank you, and it's great to talk to you.
All right, cheers. All right, very, very cool to talk to Chris, man. That was interesting, and it went a whole bunch longer than I thought it would, much like the show that we're doing so far, Martin.
Sorry about that.
But that's totally cool. Brilliant, extremely varied career, and it was nice to get some insight as to what was going on at Brands. As I told you before we started talking this evening, I was very tempted to bring Mr. Whittem in on the conversation this evening, but if I had, we would still be talking when the sun came up tomorrow morning, and yeah. So that was probably not the best idea.
People's iPods would be full, just with this show.
Yeah, and well, on top of that, they would probably be going, why don't you guys just do it live 24/7, and I'm not going to do that. I don't have the energy. On World Superbike News, we do have some information regarding Yoan Lascours, because as we well know, in testing post Imola, he did have a crash, and I think it's something that we should address, Martin.
Yeah, the latest statement the Kawasaki team have released said last Friday the doctors began to wake Yoan Lascours, but on Saturday they decided to sedate him again because there was mucus still present on his lungs and he became agitated and was trying to move. And they don't want him to do that because they still haven't been able to diagnose completely what the injuries are and what the or what the results of the injuries are. So they're going to keep him asleep for another 4 days, they said, which brings him to today, today being Wednesday the 11th, until his lungs are completely clear. So they reassess until he's brought out of sedation. Doctors and neurologists are not going to know the full extent of his injury, the chances of recovery, and the full diagnosis. So it's one of those things, guys, we just got to, you know, keep our powder dry and wait till they tell us what they can tell us. Fingers crossed. I mean, Simon Crayford was tweeting, we had on the show the other week, and what a lovely guy, and he was talking about his injury, and he said it was 2 weeks before he started to get full feeling back. So, and yet now he's fully recovered. So, you know, people shouldn't presume the worst, but at the same time, you know, at the moment, we just don't know.
And obviously, everybody at Motopond land, our thoughts are with Yoan. He's a good guy. He's a great racer. And best of recovery. And I'm sure you'll be back in one way or another.
And I've just got to quickly say there was a lovely picture put up by Danielle Teal on Twitter. And I can't remember Danielle's Twitter address, but she was she brollied for him, I presume at Miller, a couple of years ago. And she stood there with a brolly. And she's a very striking, good-looking lady. And he's looking down at her with a kind of, I mean, he's not French, but if he was, he'd be going, well, hello, my lovely. How are you? It's a fantastic picture.
I do happen to know Danielle's husband. that being one Skip Salinas. Hey, Skip, you just got a mention on Motopod, who is a privateer racing in the AMA and has perhaps the foulest mouth on the planet. and Mark Miller and I
I'm sure he's very, very proud.
I'm sure he is.
A Spaniard found his wife, so...
If I remember correctly, at Laguna last year, Mark Miller and I were hanging out in the LCR garage with both Skip and Danielle last year watching the MotoGP race. Very, very cool. We need to roll in, speaking of Mark Miller, because I will not let the show go because you folks demand it. And frankly, it's classic. So I think it's time to roll into Mr. Miller. Mark, you have the floor, my friend. Jim Race here for Motopod with Mark Miller. Hello, Mark.
Hello, Jim.
How you doing, brother?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm actually in a good mood this morning. I got some sleep. I woke up at 10 o'clock a.m., which I never, ever do. And I just woke up. I looked at the clock. It was like 9:56. And I'm like, holy shit, that's awesome. I got sleep.
Good. Well, what time do you go to bed?
It's usually around 3, something like 3 a.m.
So you've got some – okay, so I'm going to completely bypass the stuff that we talked about in pre-show. You're working on some screenplay stuff, dude.
Actually, I'm working on the script as we speak this morning, which has put me in a bit of a good mood. But I have to warn you, everyone in L.A. thinks they have a script, so it's nothing special. It's just, you know, I have to have a script to be able to walk into a restaurant and talk to somebody in L.A., you know. Oh, what's your script about? What's your script about? You know, no, but it would be the most impossible thing to get the thing actually made, but I'm super excited about it.
Is it something that you actually want to talk about, or should we save it for a future show?
There's nothing much to say other than I have a professional screenwriter friend that, you know, is involved in the industry who's read about 500 scripts. He's been working for Universal Pictures for like 30 years and stuff, and he's in on the inside. He's a bit of an intelligent lad. Has a knack for reading scripts, or I'm sorry, for organizing stories, or, you know, knowing what's shit, what's good. I've heard him speak badly about other scripts that have come across our, you know, in our friendship. He's helped other people with scripts, and he never has a good thing to say about it. He read the first 28 pages of mine yesterday and came back with a big handshake and says it's really good.
Nice.
With a couple pointers, which okay. is kind of minor, which is cool. But dude, like, I'm just stoked because I got through. Because I said, well, just wait till it's done. I don't want you to read it partially. He says, no, give it to me early so we can try to put it in the right direction. And if there's any stylistic or technical things that need to be tweaked, you'll do it more early. And I was only comfortable with the first 28 pages being sort of like a first pass, being good enough to show him.
Yep.
Because it's a bit intimidating to show somebody of 30 years at Universal to actually show him a motorcycle-based
Lost you.
What?
Lost you for a moment. Go ahead.
Okay. Anyway, so the first impression from a pro was that it is definitely, you know, sort of like sellable, doable. Okay.
Yep.
Whether or not we'll ever get to do it is going to be impossible. But stranger things have happened, and somebody's got to make the next terrible movie. So why not us, you know?
I love it. You know, that being said, that I know that your imagination, and perhaps if you need a non-dickheaded voiceover, you will remember me when you're putting your thing together.
Voiceovers need to be outlawed. I don't like voiceovers. I don't like the whole voices and all this fake pronunciation or
okay. Fine. Let me take that back. Can I have a cameo?
You can walk by in the background, but not with black purple hair. You have to have white hair.
Fuck you, man.
Oh. Anyway, can we talk about racing?
I think we should. You, my friend, seem to be pretty well set up for the Isle of Man TT once again this year. Tell me what you're doing.
Yeah, it seems that we are sorted as of about 3 days ago, which is quite late. I'm going to be doing a split lath Aprilia RSV4 in Superstock and Superbike.
Cool.
Looks like I'm going to have a couple of my best crew members back on the team. I just got a note from Dave Hopkinson, who was last year and in 2009, who says he may or may, you know, may be available to work with me again.
Yeah, try and make sure that he doesn't break his leg this year.
He doesn't need anything. All he needs is, like, you know, a sidewalk to step up onto, and he's going to break his fucking leg. So there's not much I can do about it.
Maybe I should arrive a little bit earlier this year so that I can buy him a couple of, you know, of pints of cider, and then he'll be pre-prepped so that, you know, it won't hurt so bad.
Yeah, he's up for it, I think. So but the thing is, I've got Stefan Kuhn, the guy who promotes the Macau Grand Prix sponsorships, the German who was, you know, the guy that did my visors at the TT a couple years ago when I wrote for the German team with Pico.
Yep.
Pico. He wants to come and stay at Vero's house for the TT, and now that Dave's saying he wants to come work with for me again, he was staying at Vero's house the year before while working with me, so now they may have to sleep together. That, you know, Vero will sleep in between them, and I'll have the big bed all to myself in the master bedroom.
You know, the living room is big enough. I've been in there. That you could pretty much, like, probably fit about 15 people in there if you really had to.
Well, my version is more interesting, at least in a fantasy. You know, I can dream, right?
I still remember that one picture that I took of you, Dave, and Vero from last year when it was getting dark and you were all there on your laptops. I loved that photo. It's such a classic.
It's a great photo because it shows the reflection of the light onto each of our faces of, you know, an iPad, a laptop, and, you know, a computer screen. That's what – that is today.
Yeah.
And the world is changing so fast because of the internet speed and the fact that we've got larger hard drive capacities and faster computers. We are in the Wild West right now. I mean, things are going stratoscopic. I mean, everything's going straight up.
Yep.
Because it's the streaming videos, the social networks, the way that you've got access to every single book ever written ever. You can research something and learn, you know, know everything about something in 4 days if you just stay on the websites and check it all out. It's actually, I think it's changing the way we live in a big way.
I mean, the bottom line, I think, is what you're going for is what we're getting to experience now is really fucking cool. And you're right. And it's changing so fast that, it's astounding to me. I get where you're going. And for me to try and explain it it's an interesting thing because I think that I'm probably one of those people that's sort of on the bleeding edge myself.
If you are an investor of capital and you and your mates, you know, you and your buddies have all like to chip in $20 million each to not be involved with an internet company or a startup like a Google or a Yahoo or a YouTube or a Facebook, you know, that's where the biggest money is going to be. I mean, because it stretches the globe. And with India and China getting up to speed and the Koreans and the Russians, it's – you can reach every single consumer with simply putting something viral. And if you put something like this Kony 2012 video, whether you think it's legit or not, the guy touched, you know, 100 million views on YouTube in five weeks.
Right.
And that is a good little indicator of, like, you know, if something piques somebody's interest, you have access to so many people. And it's not just to sell them shit, but to learn about them or learn about their culture or their governments and have them learn about you and your governments and way of life. It brings us all closer together so that I think hopefully it'll be harder to shoot them in the face when you want to go back and start another war.
I couldn't agree more. That's probably part of the best part about the internet is it's actually created a globalization where people aren't faceless, where you can't, you know, call somebody
evil.
Some stupid name because there's actually a person behind that.
I love it.
Yeah. Well, you and I have a tendency to agree on a lot of things, my friend. Anyway, we were talking about racing, weren't we?
Sure. Do it.
Okay. So split left. The good news on that, and in fact, I was talking about this with James Whitten this morning, is that one Brains, that being Mark Wittage, who used to build all the motors for PTR Honda and World Supersport, is building the motors and doing a lot of the design and development work for Split Lath Honda this year, or Split Lath Aprilia. And that for you, my friend, if they can tame the rear end, because that's always been the chassis, always been the issue, but if you've got a decent motor as well, you may have yourself a fucking kick-ass bike.
And James Whitten knew this?
Yeah.
Because they've got a couple good riders in BSB this year, and they've got some, I think they've got some new sponsorship on board, and this, you know, it all favors well for our TT effort if it's a reliable engine. One of the biggest thorn in our sides will be fuel consumption.
Right. But trust me, this will be a reliable engine. And maybe what I should do is, and I will do this offline, is I will put you in touch with Mark Wittage. He's a very cool cat. He's been on the show before, the man can build a good engine. He can build a reliable engine. And my only concern, of course, the two riders they've got are John Laverty, Eugene's, older brother, younger brother, one of his brothers, and Kirkham, John Kirkham, who was racing in the Evo class last year and actually podiumed on one of the Evo bikes before BSB turned into a full Evo class, which it is this year.
Yeah, I think it's all good. I think that they're teething, you know, times of have they've learned a lot of lessons along the way, and they're ready to invest in another year with all the knowledge they've got. And this will definitely translate well for our TT effort. I know I also have a teammate at the Isle of Man TT this year on Splitlath, which I don't think has been made public, so I will not say it now. But it's a guy I know and like.
I think I know who it is too, and I won't say anything either.
Right, well, it's probably going to be released any day. It's not a big deal. It's just that I'm kind of stoked to have a cool teammate, and he's also fast, which will be good for me to at least have somebody there that will have the same expectations with the machinery. And again, I'll reiterate, the fuel consumption is an issue because it's an endurance race. You've got to go two laps without running out of fuel. With right. The rule book says 23 liters max. And even if we've got it 23.01, you know, topped off with the gas cap off, it may not, with that big V4, go two laps without petering out. So it's yet to be seen. And they've got to show up with 23-liter tanks, and that's in super stock as well. I don't know how they're going to do it, but if they do, and if it works, we might have a nice package.
You remember the silly debacle with the tank last year? I still laugh about that.
No, it's terrible. I don't think they can do that again. I don't think that they'll be invited back if it doesn't work out.
Okay.
But like I said, they could show up with their best effort forward, yeah. which would be 23 liters to the rule, the yeah. letter of the law, and us still run out of fuel at the end of the lap, which we'll see. I mean, they can lean it out. We can tweak the fuel injection and all that kind of stuff to give us better economy. Or, God forbid, they ask me to not like try to conserve. That would be the worst disaster ever. Because yeah. it's not like an electric bike race with the MotoSys bike. You know, it's my job to fly the instruments and to actually use this chess match where I'm using half the throttle hold, you know, trying to regulate mile per mile, how much electricity we're using out of the batteries or how much capacity we have. Whereas on the street bikes, on the gas-powered stuff, you absolutely want to go flat the fuck out. You know, there's no, I won't accelerate as hard, or I'll roll off the throttle on top speed. What? It's a you're just killing yourself.
I guess you know. Actually, having this conversation with you, it reminds me that I need to kind of stop fucking off and figure out however I can to get back over again this year, don't I? Are you there?
Yes.
Where'd you go?
Oh, I didn't go anywhere. You said after talking to me about this, it makes you remind yourself that you have to
get the fuck back over there again this year.
Yeah, that's what I figured you were going to say. That's why I walked away, because I figured that. I guess that's what you were going to say. No, come on, Jim. Just go.
I know.
I think you should go for like – and you said last time you were there that you would not miss it until the day you die. So just remember that feeling you had.
You're right. And frankly, I was basically – on top of the world for about 3 months after that, just from having spent the time there. And people that haven't been don't get it.
I can tell you that, dude, after several months away from the TT and got that kind of thing, regarding the Isle of Man TT, I am now again starting to get those butterflies, starting to get the excitement of the fact that, one, I get to go, and two, I actually get to race it.
I know.
it's just starting to come back into, because now we're getting April 1st. May 1st is sort of the final countdown, because we start practicing by the end of May.
Yeah.
Well, that's 4 weeks away is May 1st.
Yeah.
So it's becoming more reality. And I saw something. I watched the David Jeffries piece that I had put together in that documentary in 2001. I watched it this morning just because I was trying out my new Apple TV in my bedroom. I've got the new 1080p high def Apple TV, because the last version was 720p. This one's 1080p. I wanted to see what it would look like streaming off of my iPad from my bed.
Who are you fucking at Apple to get all this stuff?
My friend from high school.
All right.
My best friend from high school. I'm not fucking him, but actually I just got the word today that my sponsorship, which is on the top of my visor, which is stickitaction.com, he's got an app for an iPhone, and it's a little Stickman game. He's going to give me an iPad 3 again. So I've got a 1, a 2, and a 3 the last 3 years, which is super cool. And he gets a tax write-off, and I get a sponsorship from my best friend in high school's little business. And it's just fun for us, and I get an iPad 3, which is, you know. So anyway, that's who I'm fucking in at Apple.
I have had printed up some very, very mini Motopod TT stickers for this year, just in case you want to take one or two of those along.
Yeah, I'd love to. Come on. Cool.
Okay, so I'll be there one way or another. I may do Kickstarter again. We'll have to see. We'll have to see.
You can hang out with Suzanne Schtick, who's coming.
Carla and perhaps the person that she's going to be umbrella girling for. So, it could be a good, it would be a good time. And, it's all a question of money. If I'm very tempted to send an email to Simon Carlin saying, do you guys sponsor journalists?
What does Simon do again?
Simon's the guy that runs a whole media department.
Of course.
Yeah. Anyway, okay. Where were we headed? The secondary question. We talked about Split Lath Aprilia, and very cool. So that's a super bike and a super stock trim. So you're going to have two different bikes, or are they going to modify them for each race?
No, there would be two separate bikes.
Okay. You're going to have a teammate?
Yes, that is the plan, but we talked about that. They haven't made it public.
Okay. Are you going to run a 600 at all?
It's possible, but I haven't even almost like asked the question in a long time whether or not there is a 600 around, but it almost typically, if I ask the question, there always is.
Okay. And
can I just say,
sure.
Kind of expand on that. The problem with the 600 stuff is the rules in 600s are so elaborate. They're near super bikes, and if right. they do World Super Sport spec 600s,
yeah.
If you don't get one that is like 150 horsepower with all the electronics, carbon fiber bodywork, the whole nine yards.
Oop, I lost you for a moment. You'll come back. Waiting.
Yeah.
Okay, you're back.
When did you lose me?
About 8 seconds. No worries, I can edit it out.
All right. If you don't have a 600 that's got 150 horsepower that is sort of a 600cc super bike with stock wheels, you're not competitive because right. those things are fast. And for me to come in third string, go, well, are there any 600s left? And they say, well, yeah, you know, mom and pop's got one over here. It's kind of fun, but it's also, I mean, it actually is really fun to have the pressure off and just go, well, I will ride mom and pop's bike because they want to be a part of the TT. And I'd like to ride in every class. And I don't care for 600s anyway. It's never been my deal. I've never liked 600s. I like the big horsepower stuff, which means my style is, you know, more adapted to the big stuff.
Right.
It's fun to be in the races, but when you get gobbled up by guys you normally beat, even behind you because they really care.
Right.
And they're also riding really, really well, and they always ride really well. But, you know, you kind of get cocky sometimes and go, oh, but, you know, I got him. I got him covered. I got him covered. But – they're not as far off as you think. And I've always said that if you're anywhere in the top 30 at the Isle of Man TT,
yep.
even beyond that, even behind that, dude, you're a very, very good motorcycle racer. There's no way you can't fake the TT racetrack. It's sick. I mean, it's like, it's very difficult. So to have slightly less equipment is not necessarily what I should be doing, even though it's fun because there's no pressure, but it still doesn't, it's not very professional.
True. So you've already got your entry obviously accepted for Superbike and I'm assuming Superstock. You got the same number this year, 20?
No, that'll be determined at the last second. They always pick what it is, but they like, you know, the electric bike stuff has become also a focus.
Yeah.
In a big way, to be honest.
And so this year should be interesting. It's my understanding that Rutter is also going to be your teammate on MotoCiz once again this year.
That's my understanding. They got two brand new bikes coming. And as you know, John McGinnis has secured an entry with a factory-backed electric bike as well. And they've already been testing.
Yep.
And it looks like, you know, of course it's going to be competitive.
Yeah, I mean, when they fly McGinnis over to Motegi to test the Mugen, which is basically sort of a semi-subsidiary of Honda electric bike, you know that they're not fucking around. They're there to basically – I think they want that $10,000, dude.
I think they want to win, And I think we'll all be over 100 this year, to be fair.
I think so, too.
And I don't think that'll be a problem. It's about winning the race. And whoever wins is going to probably post the best lap time. Here's a couple thoughts. One is it's Honda's, you know, the founder of Honda's son.
Right.
I told you the story a couple years ago. He was on the grid, the starting grid.
Yep.
One of the TT0 races. Had the biggest smile imaginable. And he was probably 40 at the time or plus. And he was just like this 6-foot Japanese thin guy with this huge grin from ear to ear because there was something new for him to kind of, you know, oh my God, you know, technical. It's like, this is a new thing. It's not Honda Civics. It's not Fireblades. Yeah. It's like, this is something completely new. And it looked like he was genuinely excited about it. And he shook my hand and I was, you know, kind of excited, stoked and privileged to have met the son of Honda. Maybe the grandson. I don't know. I think that they would, now that 2 years later, they've come back with all the resources they've got from Honda, all the R&D, the technical, the brains, the PhDs, for them to come and get John McGinnis, who's probably on a diet right now because he's a dedicated guy. He may need to. Well, he needs to lose some weight to give them their best chance to be.
I believe you did call him a fat cunt last year.
Oh, he's always going to be a fat cunt to me. I mean, you know, he's good people, but they got a good rider, which who knows the corner speed, he knows the entrance, he knows the braking markers. However, this is the second point. This is a different game.
Absolutely.
This is not the senior TT on a superbike. This is a chess match which requires conservation. And I know that's not that fun for racers most of the time, but there's always conservation in Formula One. There's fuel consumption. There's tire wear in NASCAR, whatever it is. This will be man and machine against man and machine. And it's not, you know, if John McGinnis thinks, well, fuck these guys, fuck Rutter, fuck Miller, I can beat them on equal equipment. Maybe that's true.
Yep.
But he may just need to have a learning curve that this is not flat out racing just because you're brave or know the racetrack. This also is another layer of watching the gauges and also conserving how much, because I guarantee you, even with Honda, they're not going to come up with a battery that no one else on the planet's got, I don't think.
Right.
Can go flat the fuck out for 38 miles without running out of juice.
Yeah, I mean, what you're saying is that John is going to need to, or McGee is going to need to put himself through some sort of training, if you will. Which, you know, they did at Motegi, of course, because obviously he's a smart guy and he can learn things. But he's got to learn the shit that you've been learning for the last 2 years.
3 years.
Or 3 years, yeah.
Yeah, it's not that he can't. And I guarantee you he's going to show up and do well and do the very best. But the bike kind of dictates, with the exception of a few feet, you know, a few seconds, a few tenths of a second, whatever, that John McGinnis's track knowledge and experience and talent,
yep,
he will bring his best possible input into the machine.
Sure.
The machine and his own body weight will also dictate the outcome of the race more than normal.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
So it's going to be very interesting. There's a Kawasaki factory effort as well on a ZX-10, apparently.
Really?
With a gearbox.
Really?
So bring it, you know, and MotoSys has got 4 years of experience and they are on their fourth generation of motorcycle. And apparently all I've gotten is emails from him, from Michael Sys himself and his mechanics and his engineers and his secretary that says it's going to be good. Wait till you see it.
Okay.
Which is, at the very least, if it's better than Rutter's bike last year, we're talking about the cutting edge of technology. And, you know, you don't just go and, like, you know, go up against Apple, against Macintosh, and make a better laptop that's so much better than their 64-bit i7 Intel, you know, 64-bit chip.
Yeah.
You just don't show up and, like, reinvent the wheel that big. I think it's going to be a close race, and I think it's kind of cool that, you know, I was one of the original guys that was saying 4 years ago, I said, look, it's not going to replace ice engines. It's not as cool and smelly and loud as the fun bikes that we all like to race, me included, and watch, you included.
Yeah.
But it's this technology of faster computers and faster iPhones and Androids and iPads and all this cool smaller batteries, bigger capacity and all that shit put into a motorcycle that is then placed into a motorcycle race that happens to be the Isle of Man TT as an official entry, like an official event. I think we're very lucky to have all this crossing over. All the things that are interesting to a guy like me and you right now are all funneling down into a motorcycle race that's on this island. And now that Factory Honda, John McGinnis, the legend, John McGinnis, my dumbass from L.A., Michael Rutter, who's a fantastic guy and rider, we got a good American team from Oregon. We've got a Japanese team from Honda. We got a Japanese team from, I think it's an English team. I take that back. It's a BSB team with Kawasaki with a gearbox. And the rider is, who's the kid with the mustache? Young guy, super cool, goes to Macau, been on Kawasaki. He's not Connor Cummins, but
you lost me.
Anyway, it's a good rider.
Yeah. Okay. So I basically what you just the thought you put in my head, which I know based on the nature of the gentleman, is that I need to talk to Michael. But I know that he would evade me like a motherfucker.
Yeah, I have no idea what the specs are of the bike yet.
Yeah.
For all I know, we've got a gearbox. For all I know, it's, you know, methanol powered with a little tiny 8,000 RPM motor that with a little charger on the back of it. Can you imagine? That's always
I can because if there's one thing that I will give Michael Sizz is that he always surprises. I remember taking photos of the completely whack job suspension setup that was where the quote unquote gas tank was on not your bike, the one that Rutter ran. And I'm like, I looked at Michael. I'm like, really? And I'm like, why? He said, because I can. And I'm like, okay, thumbs up. Yeah, I got to see if I can get him on the phone.
Can I tell you something a little bit more honest, a little more intimate?
Absolutely. When have you ever not?
Well, it's not very often that people even listen to you ramble on like you are asking me questions about this. So it's very rare that I would even talk about motorcycles because honestly, I'm kind of bored with motorcycle racing myself, right. Not MotoGP, but myself. So I don't talk about it. But because we've got the juices flowing and I've got a couple beers now, one of the things that's kind of cool to see from the very beginning of the TTX GP with the Moto Sis guys in Oregon, short story, it's everyone was laughing at us. You can watch the Charge movie. Everybody was saying, this sucks. They're slow. There's no noise. It's a bunch of fags racing, you know, a bunch of pisser bats. What are pisser bats racing? Battery-powered junk or something?
Yeah.
Well, of course it is. I mean, that's never been a question. Here's the cool thing about it personally. I decided long ago to just take it in a way that is sort of, well, just say, you know, say it as it's cool because it actually will be the future. Wouldn't it be the cool to be one of many, but one of the voices that says, now, wait a minute. It is cool.
Yeah.
Like, it's fucking cool and shit. And actually to ride the motorcycle, no joke, is insanely fun because there's no noise and vibration. There's only wind. So it's like you're flying. So, but I took a little bit of risk or a little bit of, you know, being sort of snickered at the very beginning saying, no, this is going to be cool. Just trust me. And now to have a Factory Honda effort and to have John McGinnis and have a Kawasaki effort, it's and still be hopefully competitive with the mom and pop shack in Oregon, which is, of course, a multi-million dollar shop.
Right.
With the likes of the brains of, you know, and the engineering of Michael Sisson and his boys. It's kind of nice to see the arc from being complete clowns to now on the internet, you're starting to see a little more interest and more respect. And it's more legitimate than ever. And it will continue to be, I hope, because fossil fuels are leaving. You know, it's a fact. But anyway, this is my speech is that it's nice to see that. And I knew this would happen. Some other people would come around. And John McGinnis is not a stupid person. He's a very, very cool individual. Yep. Very down to earth. And I mean that in not a cliche interview way. Sure. He's a very, very genuinely – he loves motorcycles and motorcycle riding and racing. And to have him be the first after Rutter, you know, superstar who sat on the wall a couple years ago, and it's on YouTube, of him looking kind of going, ah, well, you know what? Hats off. They've worked hard. There's some really interesting motorcycles here. Well, he was talking about the Moto Sis bike.
Yeah.
There wasn't any other interesting motorcycle on the grid other than that one Moto Sis bike. looked cool. All the rest looked like fucking, you know, battery powered scrap. It's just fact.
That shit, yeah.
You know, all power to them, all love, no, nothing taken away. I'm just saying that the fact that they rolled out that one, they took off that cover and it had those cassettes of those battery packs that looked like something from a, you know, an HP printer. And they had the little blue lights and the design of the carbon fiber chassis with everything, with all the magnesium wheels and the carbon, the Brembo monoblocks. Hats off to Michael Siss and his friends and his workers, whatever, to show up with such conviction and such style and actually almost sustain this. I'm not sure if this would have survived if it wasn't for Michael Siss, is my only point. So I took off of that and said, well, let's show up with a nice clean set of leathers and I'll do my part, which is, of course, I'll steer the motorcycle. I know how to do that. That's easy. But also, if the camera ever comes into my stupid idiot face, say, I think it's cool. Fuck these guys. You know, fuck the guys that are these guys that don't get it yet. You know, it's okay.
Yeah.
It's okay. But
you do know. I know.
I know. I just wanted to say it. So that it's clear that I'm happy that John McGinnis is now coming around, and I can't wait to talk to him in person the next time I see him. How is it? No, after he rides the first practice, because it's one thing riding an electric bike on a short circuit, but to have the open roads where you can really sustain a long, long flowing straightaway left and right through the pubs and the trees and stuff with an electric motor is, you know, it's a little different than accelerating down a short straightaway and then braking.
Oh, totally.
I want to hear what just one-on-one off to the side with no one around. I would love to hear his impression, because I've been very, very lucky to also experience what it's like to race an electric motorcycle around that TT course, which is 38 miles down public roads. It's such a surreal feeling. Truly, genuinely, it's great. It's like, there's no fucking noise. Like, and you're going in and out of like these hedges and stuff. And you're like, well, what? I'm flying. You know, it's weird. It's anyway, I'd like to talk to John about that.
Yep. Well, I re-released a quick chat that I had after, I think it was your guys' second practice, where maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, after the Mugen got announced, which is the Mugen quote-unquote Honda that McGinnis is going to race, where he was watching you guys come back in. And I was joking with him. I'm like, so what do you think? He's like, I want one. I want one.
Yeah, of course.
And I'm like, no, you're just saying that. I mean, I know you think they look cool. He's like, no, I want one. So
it's something new.
And frankly, it raises the level of competition, and it forces everybody to bring more of their game, which is good for the sport and the technology.
You know, it would be fascinating, and touch wood, when there is the first fatality of a rider racing a TT0 motorcycle. There will be a profile to that happening as well. And you know, it's bound to happen over time. I'm not saying it's got to happen anytime soon. But, you know, when you're talking about having limited motor and limited capacity of battery charge, you might find yourself asking for a little bit more braking, a little bit more corner speed, which could catapult you off the side of a cliff. Because
it's an interesting thought. I don't see anybody bursting into flame from, you know, or sparks flying down the road. But your point being, and frankly, Mark, you could hearken this back to the days of when they still ran 125s and 400 series there. Anybody's going to take whatever they can and push it to the edge, whether it's electric or ice. It doesn't matter.
Well, here's another parameter of that. You don't get to ride this bike very much. And it's extraordinarily, extremely heavy.
Yeah.
It's nearly, you know, it's nearly a Goldwing. And it doesn't steer necessarily great. But you can also, it also breaks very, very strangely, because it's so, it's like this mass of lead, literally lead, a square piece of fucking lead between your legs, right under the tank.
Yep.
And you brake, you don't slow down. It's like, so no, seriously, you got to adapt to the way that the physics and the geometry, whatever the physics involved, when you jump off your Fireblade and your 600 and your Aprilia RSV4, whatever it is, and you say, well, okay, it's race time. I get one lap at this. I've only ridden it three times. You know, it's only three laps. Right. I'd love to win the race and beat the 100-mile-per-hour average and also beat John McGinnis, or John McGinnis will say, I'd like to win the very first time out and, you know, and secure myself as the first, you know, the first time I ever rode, I won.
You also want that watch.
I want the watch desperately for winning. You get a special watch when you win the race, and I gave it away the first time I won it, and I would like to keep it the next time.
Yep.
Because even though I make $10,000 a year, I'd like to have this, you know, $20,000 watch on my hand when I go out, and so the chicks can see it and think I'm cool and rich, and I can check.
No. That might help with your script, right?
I'm kidding. But I could see somebody saying, well, I'm going to try to make up some ground without using the motor and try a little bit hard on an unfamiliar motorcycle when you've been riding other motorcycles all week for 2 weeks. And then you come to the TT Zero race and you're like, all right, that's it. Best effort. You might just actually make a small error because you don't really know the motorcycle as well as you know the other kinds of motorcycles with engine braking, with when you downshift and the rear wheel, you know, skids out and it sort of slows you down corner speed, mid corner speed, that kind of thing. Typically, I mean, there's some regen you can dial in, but that's also there's some reliability issues with the regen. But when you get off the throttle and on the big Brembo monoblocks on these electric bikes, it just kind of it's like a 250.
Yeah.
You hear the chain and the noise from the front brake calipers rubbing against the front brake rotors, but there's no engine braking.
Right.
So and you're talking about a 600-pound road racing crotch rocket.
Yeah.
So you can see after 38 miles, which takes 20 minutes, after 20 minutes of nonstop, every split second, every tenth of a second is scrutinized or you're dead, there could be an error because you are ever so slightly off. You're ever so slightly misjudging what you thought was a 1,000cc Fireblade. You are now on a 600-pound electric motorcycle with no engine braking. There's the potential there for rider error due to the fact that there's less exposure to the, you know, the environment.
Well, it might be a decent reason to stay away from the 600s if you're talking to your mom and pop shop. I would not be surprised this year if, in fact, I will be surprised this year if there are not more people that are coming in with regen stuff.
I don't know how much it helps. I know that it's easier to ride when they dialed it up. They dialed it up to the max the last time where I got off throttle and there was a decel.
Yeah.
Even though you're talking about electronic decel, it's not the same thing as rotating pistons where you...
Hold on. Let me pause you for a moment because there are probably a lot of people who don't know what we're talking about. So on an electric race bike, basically what happens, there is the capability of doing regeneration through deceleration. So basically when you get off the throttle, power gets fed back into the battery system and it can help charge it back up again because part of the problem is keeping a solid charge in the battery system. So I didn't mean to pause you, my friend, but I just want to make sure people understand that.
Yeah, the generator that is propelling your motorcycle forward becomes an alternator when you get off the gas.
Right.
It's the exact same, you know, shaft.
Yep.
The drum with the brushes and the whatever. And it can create some engine braking to the rear wheel as you get off the throttle, but it kind of clicks on. It's not analog. It's not tactile like it is on a gas-powered bike, which is feeding more fuel air charge.
Interesting.
I never
thought about that. You know, it would be interesting. Okay, so and here is an interesting question that brings up because you were talking about we may have some bikes there with gearboxes. If you had a clutch and you had KERS or regen, there might be some stuff you could pull off that might give you a little bit of an edge.
I think a gearbox would be terribly helpful. I just don't know how it completely integrate because the way it feels when you're riding these new contraptions,
yeah,
is kind of like this buggy where there used to be a steering wheel, which was a little arm that went a shaft went straight up between the two people on the seat, and you rotate it right and left this little arm, and you kind of like push the throttle by rotating this little dial on the steering wheel thingy. And that creates throttle, and then you go down the horse and buggy, you know, you go down a dirt road. as if you are a horse and carriage, but instead it's propelled by this steam-powered engine or something. When you're riding the electric bikes, it's kind of like that because everything is different. You know sort of what it's supposed to act like. It's supposed to act like downshifting with deceleration of engine braking. But it's not actually engine braking.
Yeah.
It's a solenoid that has an adjustable point of turning on and off and to what degree. So it's a Band-Aid, if you will. It's almost like you just go into the OS and you pull up the – you go up the terminal and you pull up the code and you change the number on the code to a different factor. And Michael's cool about always – Michael Siss is cool. Him and I love talking to Michael Siss because seeing his technical brain. You know, I went to university 5 years to be a pilot and stuff, but he's got – like he'll show me an arc. He'll create an arc on a napkin sitting there with an ink pen and just show me, well, here's if, you know, if we get on the ink, then we get off the throttle and it clicks on here. And then as it goes down, we can dial it up at this particular wheel speed and and he can graph it. So he shows me one graph this direction, one graph that direction. And just to see how much control he's got over this digitally, it's a different game, dude. It's like super fun because I'm the monkey that's actually flying this piece of this magnesium horse, you know, this contraption between my legs.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so it's not going 197 miles an hour, but like we've said, 137 miles an hour, you hit a tree, it's still going to hurt. So I'm physically manipulating this contraption, but he's feeding all these different parameters of we don't have engine braking or a gear shift or a downshift or a feathering the clutch or a slipper clutch or whatever. I'm trying to adapt to this wild, wild west horse and buggy where now you can, you know, just move the lever to move the front wheels and you rotate that dial a little bit to get a little bit more throttle and you figure it out and you try not to run over children. I kind of like that. It really is. But it's also a race, which means I know the racetrack and I just got off the super stock bike, which means I'm up to speed and I'm trying to get up to speed to where I know the tires are capable of. At least at 430 pounds. I know what the exact same tires are capable of, but I don't know what it's going to do at 600 pounds with no engine braking, with it clicking on and all these other parameters. It's a very cool adventure, and it's not necessarily easy.
So, well, and on top of that, you have no idea what the answers are because, as we both know, Michael's one cagey motherfucker. He doesn't release anything to anybody, including you or me or anybody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's fine. I mean, I'm all about it. I mean, for him to show up with the very best thing, meaning that he has to work on the bike till the last 36 seconds before somebody slaps his hand and says, I got to shut the door. You know, I got to shut the crate and nail that last clicker, whatever it is, you know, turn the last dial to ship the thing off. For them to work on it to the last second and then continue to work on it after they get it on the island and they're down at their house and they take it out of the crate and they put it in their garage and they're working on it until they're late for technical inspection, till they roll it down the pits and I'm already in my leathers ready to go and they're still tweaking it. This is fun stuff. You feel like a test pilot, you know, doing the X1 glamorous Glennis of Chuck Yeager being dropped out of the bay, the Bombay door of a
perfect analogy. Perfect fucking analogy. What was I going to ask you? There was a question that was in my head that I desperately wanted to ask. Have you since obviously you and Rudder chilled out at Macau a bit. Have you talked to him any more since then about running on the electrics?
No, not really. I don't think there's any. There's so much involved that it's. We both know riding motorcycles, and I got to tell you, guys who ride motorcycles for money, meaning they do it all the time, that's the last thing they talk about.
Yeah,
they talk about is which girl in the pub is the cutest, and, you know. But to say simply, what did you think of the electric bike experience? Meaning, actually physically manipulating the bike, counter steering, braking, accelerating, because all the rest is the same. We all know the racetrack. We all know everything. You know, fuck that. And he says, it's really cool. That's about all that would be said and need to be said.
All right, so let's let that entire dog lie. Today is tomorrow. Will we have April Fool's Day? Will it not? Or next day? We're coming up on it, aren't we?
Tomorrow.
Yeah. And we've got a massive, massive show this week, and I need to figure out how to cram you in. And I'm looking at the clock right now, Mr. Miller, as you and I always do. And I'm coming up on an hour.
Can I predict that Ben Spies will do very well this year on the 1,000?
I would say that he will probably podium at least 5 times.
I think he'll do better than that. It's his second year, as he said on the website recently. It's his second year on the same team for the first time in forever. He's going to be on a high-powered motorcycle that will propel his weight.
Yep.
He's always proven to be somebody that's dedicated to get up front in such a situation.
Yep.
And I don't think anything will change. I think he's hungry. I think he's ready and he's healthy.
So have you heard my ballsy CRT prediction?
No.
I say a CRT bike will get on the grid, or I'm sorry, get on the box.
That will not happen. And you're an idiot for saying so.
I will bet you, a case of Magners.
I can do that. I can do that. What's that about? $24?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay. Are you fucking out of your fucking mind,
dude? You don't know the things I know, my friend.
Okay, so the Aprilia's got horsepower. Who's riding it?
De Puna.
Huh? He's pretty good.
Duh. Yeah,
I don't think so, dude.
There's 5 other Aprilias on the grid, on the CRT grid.
He would have – one of those guys would have to beat Lorenzo, Spies, Danny Pedrosa, Colin, the English chap, Cruxlow, his teammate.
Have you ever heard of this thing called rain, Mark?
Oh, so you're trying to – you're betting on the fact that somebody like Randy could ride an Aprilia in the rain superior than all the other aliens in the rain on their regular bikes.
All I'm saying is that I've got a case of Magners against you.
All right. That
a CRT bike will be on the box before the year is out. I thought I was nuts, and now you're like, oh, fuck.
Oh, I try to help you. I guide you, and I tell people behind your back that, no, he's really okay. He's not as dumb as he looks. And then you say something ridiculous like a CRT bike is going to get on the podium.
A year from now, I'm going to make you kiss my ass, brother.
Oh, that's next year. That's not this year.
I'm just saying, you are going to lose this bet. All right. I know you're feeling bad about it already, aren't you?
I don't feel bad about it. I lost my friend. I mean, I just feel like I respected you, and now I just don't know what to think about you, Mike. What's your name? Jim?
I don't know you either.
All right. Anyway.
Once again, thanks a bunch. Always a howl. Martin, I don't think you've heard that one yet, and so you'll...
No, I've not. I've not listened to any of them yet.
You've not got the patience, do you?
Well, no, I just don't have the time.
And much like some of our listeners that are going to be thinking after we're done with this show, my friend. Yeah. What do we got coming up? Well, we already know that we already talked about BSB, and we talked about BSB, and Martin, I'm not going to go through this very much because I did talk about it in depth with... Mr. Walker, but we'll run through the top 10 very quickly. We know that the place got rained out after race two was called off. Kirkham, Seeley, Rudder, Lowry, Mason, Tony Bridewell, Shaky Byrne, Westmoreland, Foray Brooks, and on down the pack. It was a kind of a bad end on a bank holiday Monday to what had been sort of a really interesting lead up for the first Brands Indy race.
Yeah, it was a shame. It was a washout.
Yeah. So that's what's there. We need to figure out how to close this out. What's coming up? We've got AMA Pro Superbike at Road Atlanta this weekend. You guys will remember last week that we talked to Elena Myers. She says she's healing up really well and is ready to go.
BSB, as we mentioned before, is coming up at Thruxton this coming weekend.
And we've weekend after, there is World Superbikes from Assen.
Yep.
Which is on a Sunday. It's weird.
No, really?
Yeah. Well, I think the MotoGP thing is it goes back 40, 50 years, because Assen, I believe, is the longest running track where
Martin, you just said Assen is on a Sunday. It's going to be on a Saturday.
No, it's Saturday for MotoGP.
Right.
Superbikes, the race is on a Sunday.
How bizarre is that?
That's my point. I think when MotoGP started, however many, 70 years ago, or not, it wasn't called MotoGP then, because on religious grounds, they only raced on a Saturday, so it became a tradition, which is stark. But because World Superbikes is only, 20-odd, whatever it is, years old.
25 this year, it was 52.
Oh, but... yeah, of course. Cool. So they race on a Sunday. So it's on a week on Sunday, we got that. But we'll have another show between then and now, probably a 3-minute show to say, sorry, we're not doing a longer show than this because you're still probably listening to last week's show. Thank goodness iPods have pause buttons, eh?
And they come with larger storage capacity, too.
Yeah.
What else is going on? Once again, the Motopod Fantasy League is kicking ass. You guys can still join anytime during the year. You can find us on facebook.com/motopod. We will have a link to chriswalkerraceschool.com in the show notes. And, of course, if you'd like to help figure out how you can get us to actually go to the races instead of talk to each other over these stupid microphones and get us to get in the face, in-person interviews with the racers, except for over the phone, which, frankly, is not bad, but... when you catch people off guard, that's always more fun. You can always donate through motopodcast.com or through the Facebook fan page. Martin, we've done it again. We've created a monster.
I know. For people with tight schedules, I am so sorry. I just really hope that it brings, I don't know, a thought to someone and just starts to run a train of thought, or in some way we've illuminated something that people might not have thought about, or we've just generated a conversation over a pint down the pub. But the guys who listen love the stuff that we love. That's why we're talking about it, and that's why they listen to it. But one thing I will say, on the back of Paul from the desert, and I won't give away your surname again, because once was enough, to be honest, Mr. Creevy. I'm really sorry about that. But that would be indiscreet to mention his full name again. But no, emails like Paul's are fantastic. If you've got thoughts running through your head, get them down, not on paper. Just send us an email, but don't try and construct it. Just send us your thoughts as they come, because they are fantastic. It's the raw file. And it's those things that really let us know what you guys want and what you guys are interested in, what's fascinating you and what's frustrating you. And that's, we are a listener-driven show.
You know, Martin, that's what got you in trouble was your stream of consciousness. And
exactly. We're going to end up with 147 hosts on this show because these guys are all going to go, right, that's the route.
Good. Maybe I can go on vacation. I could use one.
Yeah.
All right, all. Thanks so much for taking the time to download. And if you've listened to the show before the end of July, we applaud you from afar. And enjoy all of the racing we've got going on. And we were looking forward to talking to you guys next week.
Yep. And I'd just like to sign off by saying, vamos, Jorge.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Bye, all.
Good night. We'll be right back.
I, Martin, am going to, because I need to do a bio break, dude.
Jesus, we going that long?